Let's come to order, shall we? Okay. Well, I want to welcome you all. We could have actually balanced the budget by selling admission to the seats we have. We just won't tell the fire marshal. Actually, they don't have any money left anyway. Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance and Policy Joint Meeting. I'm very pleased that so many could attend. We have a tremendous task awaiting us, if you haven't been keeping track. I feel sort of like as we are going up, we just came back from Colorado skiing to see our one-year-old grandson. I have to get a plug-in for Wesley. We went up in the mountains, and you see the mountains in the distance, and you think, that's a pretty big mountain, you know? And you get a little closer to the mountain, and then you're actually on the side of the mountain. From the side of the mountain looks a little taller than it did from the ground. And you get close to the top, and it's like, we have got a large mountain on our hands. There's some honest, good respect that should go with that as you avoid becoming part of the landscape. I think that the task that awaits us is relatively similar, and at least my sense of it is. Just to give you the bit of the lay of the land for today, we'll talk about the upcoming work a little later in the meeting, but we are here to work, and we won't go past 4:30, which is the time of the joint meeting. Is that right? 4:30, you're done. We might get done earlier than that, but that's up to him because he'll have the second half of the meeting. But my goal today is to get through a lot of the overall math, the forecast, healthcare access fund, the medical assistance expansion numbers, so we all agree, at least have been exposed to the numbers once. We have a goodly number of freshmen here, and they've all been given study packets to look at home, and some have gotten through them, and that's helpful. The test in this class is not given until March, when we have to get our work done and get some bill produced here. So I'm going to offer a few thoughts for a few minutes, and we're going to hear from Senator Han, who was gracious enough to join us today, and he'll offer a couple thoughts. And then we'll kind of review the schedule, and then I want you to meet our new members, the members of our committee. They'll get 30 seconds or 45 seconds to say who they are and what kind of topic area they want to work on. And we could give you 5 minutes, but that would take till the whole time. So you'll have to fight that temptation. But I'm really impressed with the cadre of members we have on the committee, and I'm very impressed with the staff that we have to serve us in this challenging time. So we're hitting the ground running, and that's why we're meeting today. It would have been impolite to meet yesterday. That's why we're because we have so much to review and to manage. And those of you in the audience who are lobbyists have been reading the papers, those citizens who are paying attention to this, notice there's a whole new landscape. We have a new governor from a party that's not been represented for a couple decades. We have a new change in the legislature by a party that's not been represented in this way in decades or quadrades or for 38 years or more. We have new commissioners. I want to commend Commissioner Ellinger, who reached out to me on New Year's Day. Thought that was a very good idea to start those dialogues going. And Washington has changed, if you didn't notice. And the deficits that they face are no different much than ours. And if we fail to recognize that, then we will find ourselves in harm's way. And when you have a 09 deficit of $1.4 trillion, a 010 deficit of $900 billion, and a 011 deficit facing $1.8 trillion after the new stuff they did, I'm concerned as we keep building programs based upon that money coming eternally could be something that might require more faith than I have. And so my concern is to create sustainability for 4 to 10 years out. I'm concerned if we don't manage this area humanely, with respect for the people that we serve and care so much about, that we'll find ourselves unable to serve them. We'll have many chances for all kinds of bipartisan discussions, and I'll give everybody a chance to express themselves at appropriate times. But one thing I want to chat about just off the top is this idea of cuts versus less increases. And there's all kinds of ways to describe what our budget will be. But I'll predict it to be higher than last year's budget in true general fund dollars, counting the stimulus money as not being taken away from that. And so many of you have had jobs in the private sector, and you were thinking a 10% raise would come your way, and only got a 1% raise. None of you said you had a 9% cut. You said you had a lousy, measly, crummy 1% raise. And we'll have time to discuss about that, but I'm just telling you my view about that. There's just, as you read the forecast, which we'll have some very good testimony about, you'll discover that all the shifts and deferrals and tomorrow things have come to land on us today. And over $200 million of those are landing right in our budget as a special New Year's gift. And that's going to make our work even more hard. Hopefully today, as we listen to the math from the department about the forecast and the status of those funds, we can have facts we agree on, and we can discuss our philosophies and points of view and choices we would make. But at least we need to be able to agree on the facts. And since this is all coming on us all of a sudden, the relaxed state that we've had in the past about we can do this in a year or two, the department will need 4 years to ramp this program up or whatever, we need to change on a dime. And the better we can do that, the better we can encourage our good state employees and the department staff to move along with things we've known we wanted to do for a long time, the better this all going to be. And we've talked about efficiency, we've talked about lean services, we've talked about effectiveness. Well, now we have to actually see it happen. And I'm convinced there's enough money in the system, plus a little bit of inflation we're going to have, to serve all the people in ways that are essential and even important. If you have heard me comment at all in the past, since 2003, I've coined essential, important, and nice. And we have to focus on what's essential. We have to decide what that is. We have to focus on what's important. And if it's simply nice to do, it's going to be harder to want to think we can keep doing that. And that will not be very pleasant, but I think at the end we can preserve the essential and important needs of people we care so much about. I'm convinced we should not pay for what doesn't work. We're in the situation many families are in now, where they have made choices and they expect us to do that too. That's what I'm here to do. The historic house priorities have been care for the disabled, nursing homes, and a safety net. And I think we agree that those are really important things. We're going to add to that priority list other things we find to be equally essential and important. But I think that that's just what I've noticed in the past. And I we've had differences with the Senate, different leadership on other matters. If you haven't heard essential, important, and nice yet, you're going to hear it a lot of times. I've had the privilege of meeting with many of your groups so far, many different. I'm surprised how popular I've become. and there's been a theme that some of have expressed, and I appreciate the thought. They say, I understand money is tight, and that you have to make some decisions, and if you have to cut someone else, I fully understand why that's going to be, or retrench their services, they are just wasting money. But our program, let me just tell you about our program, and let me tell you about your program. I think it's a great program, whatever it is, and I think it serves a need, or it did at one time. But we have to find a way to do that same work without any excess in it, so we can focus on what's important. If we cannot, then something you really care about will have to go by the wayside, and I'm not comfortable with that. There's some easy answers been offered to me about what we should manage the budget about, and I'm not interested in just lopping off an entire program. I don't see the value in that. And that'll be a discussion for March more. So as we look forward to our work, and we'll be talking targets, they're not anywhere near being released, they won't come out until after the February forecast. But the target I'm working from as a working target, just to start, is flat. So don't fall over sitting in the audience. But we have to start there, because I know we'll have that much money. I don't know how much more. I expect more than flat. But as we look at that as a number, then we can see that all the dollars we're investing in some services that aren't so productive are easier to say, why are we doing that? the more I look at this, the more I just get frightened, because this is going to be a task. And so what I'm looking for from you at the table, and those in the audience who represent groups and who know what kind of programs you offer, are ideas about how to do it a little differently. We'll be starting on Tuesday with a group coming forward with their ideas already to talk about that. And you know, if you need to do an offer, an idea confidentially, then just give it to me. I won't identify who it came from, but we are just going to have one time of it here. I've gotten some emails from some people saying, "What would Jesus do?" You know, like Jesus, like I don't know what he would do. But I thought about it actually, and this morning I was just getting ready for today. There was a guy named Stephen who was after one of the disciple guys. And they were having trouble with feeding the widows. And so the first private sector nonprofit was Stephen feeding widows with the monies that had been donated. And at least I can go back that far with some kind of historical thing. And I think that's it's good to care about people like that. And I think that Minnesotans do. We have historically been a very generous state, caring about people who have needs. And we're not going to change about that. And so, just in terms of nonprofits, a lot of them are very concerned, and I don't blame you. We absolutely need your help. We need your help in focusing the services you provide. Maybe we should give more to you to do. Maybe you should give more to us. I don't know the answer. But just think about what you do. I mean, they gave me an award one time. A couple of years ago, I offered to give it back because we were having some retrenchment problems then, too. I understand and appreciate the value of that. But maybe it's time to merge some nonprofits, merge some programs to focus on what's important so you can get your work done better. You're going to learn today that the forecast is not getting any better next cycle. You know, some people say we should just get rid of all those state employees. They're just, and the state employees I have met are a value to the system. They don't make a tremendous amount of money, but they work hard. They know their work. And I see them as part of the solution. And so, as the state leads the way by becoming even more productive and more focused with our workers, then I think that we can manage our way through this time. So I wanted to express those thoughts to you. Here we are. Let me give you a little view of the future. Today we're going to spend time going through, as I mentioned, the forecast, the Healthcare Access Fund, which has some bad surprises in it, and the expansion. And there'll be time for interaction about that. But that's the agenda for the rest of the day. And so we'll be taking a break somewhere in the middle, and then Representative Gottwell will take over chairing. Senator Hankins can stay a little while. He'll get the comment in a minute here. In fact, I think I'll let you offer your comments now. Then I'll go over the next week's plan, and then we'll get into our introductions. Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Abler and Chairman Gottwald, and thank you, members of the House. It's an honor for me to be here in your committee. I'm used to being in this building. My office was here for a number of years, recently moved across the street, but it's very familiar to be here and very honored to be invited to be a part of your committee. And I'm here to listen and learn, but also just to share with you that both Chairman Abler and Chairman Gottwald and I, the three of us, have met jointly and met individually for a number of occasions, and we've talked a lot about what we think we need to do and how we want to do it. And our hope is that we will, as two legislative bodies, the Senate and the House, that we will work together closely. In the Senate, we don't have two committees. You have the luxury, in a way, of having two committees with policy and a budget side and lots of members. Of course, you have more members in the House than we do in the Senate in the first place, but we have that all in one committee. But we are really working hard to try to make sure that we do this as effectively as we can and with as minimal confusion as we can. And so part of this is a pledge to you that in the Senate side that we are going to work with you in the House very closely so that we can put together a good bill and good policies and get those things passed as expeditiously as we can. And I think Chairman Abler pointed out, we face a daunting challenge. We all know that. That doesn't make it any easier. I think from my sense, there is nobody that I've talked to that doesn't share the commitment that we all have to do this well. We understand how important it is, and we understand how necessary it is, and we want to do it well. And we believe there's room to do it better. And we have to find a way to do it better because the resources that we will be able to bring to this are going to be limited, which is no different than what our common experience is as individuals. I come from a business background. We all have to deal with budget constraints and with the desires to do things and the inability to do everything we desire. And that's what we have to face today. But to me, the commitment and the desire that people have, and particularly members of the legislature, to do this well is very strong, and we want to honor that. And I don't have the answers for this, and I don't think any one of us has the answers, and that's why we have committees and why we have advice from members of the public and departments and other interested parties. And as daunting as this will be, I'm looking forward to it because it is important work, and there's nothing better for us to do than work on important things. And that's, I think, for many of us who serve in the legislature, why we came in the first place. So I hope I know we'll have challenges. I know we won't always agree. I know that there'll be disagreements between the House and the Senate, and we'll have to take our robes and wigs off and come over and talk with you and figure that out, as I've done today. But we will. I just want to make sure that there is at least an awareness that we in the Senate are very interested and desirous of working with you in the House to do this well, and we will do that. So thank you again for allowing me to participate, at least briefly. I will not, as Chairman Abler mentioned, be able to stay for the entire meeting, but I would like to stay for a while and hear some of the discussion and some of the presentation, and because I need to learn as much as anybody else. And so every opportunity I can take to learn, I'm going to take it. Thank you. But thank you again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator. Now let me talk about, and I appreciate you stopping in. Let me just talk about the schedule a bit. We're going to meet probably in all our times that we have, I would be convinced of that. Tomorrow is the youth and government, so you get that day off, so you can read some more homework you have with you. You'll be getting quite a bit of handouts. I don't know if we'll go through every one of them, but at least that's there. Some of those there for your reference. We'll talk about those. On Tuesday, I mentioned we're going to get a group coming forward to talk about some reform ideas, innovation ideas, and any group that wants to present innovative ideas. Kind of run them by me, but if they sound like they're all, you know, workable, I will give you time to bring those forward in public. Or if it's you need to keep them private, then I'll just think of myself. And we're also going to talk about hospital funding, just in a way to get our arms around that topic. We're going to be taking kind of in-depth looks on different committee days to, like, just one day per topic, and there's so many topics. We're not going to do a lot of orientation. Here's the department. There may be a little bit of that. I'm not sure how we'll do that with the policy, with the reform committee, or with mine. We're meeting tomorrow to figure out some of that stuff. And then Wednesday is the One Minnesota, is that what it's called, thing over at the Humphrey. That is a really good thing to go to. If you're going to meet people, you're not going to brush shoulders with, you'll see some senators there, and that's always good to get to know the senators. And so if you can go and spend the day, you will find yourself well-rewarded in content, but also in the networking. And so Wednesday, we're not going to be meeting. And then on Thursday, we're going to start getting into the waiver programs. And whichever, you know, my partisan view, I'm about the work. And we are all on different sides and all that. But this is, the best we can, I hope we can keep about the work. And that doesn't mean don't say something you think you need to say. But to the DFL in particular, if there's things you think we should look into, just even to address as a topic here that maybe I forgot, I'm open to that. So I know what I know and I know what I don't know, and I'm counting on you to fill in the gaps about that. One thing we're going to do, and then we'll try to keep you ahead of the schedule so you know what's going to happen. We're going to do some planning tomorrow about that. I mean, our staff just got hired yesterday, so I think we're doing pretty good. There's folders. And the reform members had folders that were slow to come. So, but they don't meet till later. They have 2 hours yet that they meet. We're going to, in order to try to dissect these topics and to go into some depth, I'm not going to have official working groups or hearings about all them, but we're going to have members work in twos and threes on topical areas, much the same as Representative Hosh dug into PCA and other people in the past have dug into those things. To find ways to understand them better and find some efficiencies, economies, or whatever. And so we'll figure out what those topics may be. And every member is welcome to be on one. And I think, I mean, two if you wanted, but I think one is practical just to have the time to dig into it. And then we'll well, those will be rolled out at some point. So with that, we've already met the Senator Hand. Just for ease of introductions, I think we'll start with just go around here, and there's some staff in the back there too. So I would like to, we had some good encounters with our own group talking, but I think if you can maybe just say hello in 30 to 45 seconds and maybe some topic areas you want to address, and then we'll move into our presentation, and there'll be ample chance for discussion about that. So, who are you?
I'm Christine Keel, and I will be the committee administrator for the HHS Finance Committee.
John Walls, House Fiscal Staff.
I'm Representative Diane Loeffler. I represent Northeast Minneapolis. I've been involved in the committee in the past, working primarily on health care, public health and prevention, and services to people with disabilities.
I'm Tara Mack, representative from District 37A, which is Apple Valley and Burnsville. Have served on the policy committee in the past and will now be on both the finance and the reform committee, and am anxious to work on any area of reform across the system. I believe there's a lot of opportunities and look forward to that, as well as particularly issues making sure that folks with disabilities are held at a high priority in terms of making sure they're getting the funding they need.
I'm Representative Larry Hosh. I represent District 14B in central Minnesota, just to the west of St. Cloud. Outside of the legislature, I work with people with disabilities. I'm teaching independent living skills, primarily those with mental, cognitive, and physical disabilities. I'm also a soon-to-be recovering business owner and potentially starting a new business venture also.
I am Nora Slawick, 55B, which is the east metro suburbs of Maplewood and Oakdale. I have 3M is the best known thing in my district. I am the lead on early childhood. Prior to this legislature, we had a committee on early childhood, which about $440 million, over $200 million, that is in this committee. I work on things like basic sliding fee, child care development grants, trying to close the achievement gap so that we can save that money at the later level. We can get to kids when they're younger and to help them and their families. We could save a lot of money here in the state. So I'll be working on those types of issues.
I'm Carolyn Lane from 50A. That's just north of Minneapolis, Columbia Heights, Fridley, St. Anthony Village. And I was on the policy committee last time.
I'm Representative Patty Fritz from Rice and Steele County out in Greater Minnesota. I'm a licensed practical nurse of 40 years, 35 of those years working in the St. Lucas Nursing Home in Faribault, which is my hometown. I'm the nursing home legislator, and so that's probably what I'm best known for.
Good afternoon. I'm Tina Liebling. I'm from 30A, which is part of Rochester. The Mayo Clinic main campus is in my district. And I'm going into my fourth term now, and I have served on both Health and Human Service committees for the last two terms, and I'm the lead on the Reform Committee.
Hi, my name is Jeff Hayden. I represent South Minneapolis, District 61B. I was on both Health and Human Service committees last term, and I'm going to serve on the Finance Committee this year. I've worked on issues regarding the safety net, one of the things that Representative Abler talked about he wants to look at closely and preserve, as well as issues around some of our most vulnerable citizens, including those that are homeless and have mental and chemical health issues. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Rena Moran. I'm the newly elected state representative from District 65A, which is the St. Paul, Frogtown, Rondo, North End neighborhoods, and really excited to be here. And my hope is to listen, learn a lot, and so that we can get to a good place that we are representing and strengthening families in our state.
Hi. My name is Representative Erin Murphy, and I represent a district in St. Paul, the one that has St. Thomas, McAllister, and Cafe Latte, which is probably its most famous location. I'm a registered nurse. I know there are a number of nurses on the committee. I don't practice clinical nursing now, but I do teach in the DNP program at the University of St. Catherine. And I've spent, I think, most of my time in the past 4 years working on reform, the bipartisan reform that's been supported both in the House and the Senate. hospital finances and workforce issues, and I will continue to work on those as well as issues regarding the aging population.
My name is Andy Lear, and I'll be the committee legislative assistant for the HHS Finance Committee.
Hi, I'm Shirley Koderick. I will be the CLA for the HHS Reform Committee.
Dan Pollack, DFL research staff for both committees.
Rod Hamilton, I represent District 22B, which is all of Cottonwood County, Jackson County, and four townships in Nobles County, and my interest lies with people with disabilities and nursing homes.
I'm Diane Anderson. I'm a freshman this year, elected in House District 38A, and so this is my first time on this committee. I'm in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and I'm interested in working with the hospitals and probably chemical dependency.
I'm Representative Maury Lanning from Moorhead, starting my fifth term. This is my first time on this committee, Human Services Committee. However, the last several years, I've been very much involved with the poverty issue, having served on the bipartisan commission to end poverty in the state of Minnesota, and I'm currently co-chair of the legislative task force that's trying to come up with various legislative initiatives that we can enact to address that issue in our state. And so you can expect our task force, including Representative Hosh and Representative Fritz and Representative Szymanski, who will be bringing ideas to you.
I'm Representative Joe Schumacher from District 22A, which is extreme southwest Minnesota. We border South Dakota and Iowa. And I used to work in a hospital in my previous life for a few years, and my interests lie in nursing homes.
Representative Mary Franson, District 11B, the eastern part of Douglas County and all of Todd County. I am a licensed professional daycare provider. That's what I did before winning the election here. Early childhood is very important to me. I was able to raise my two youngest children in the home and really thoroughly enjoyed raising those that trusted my care to raise their children while the parents were at work. And I think that is very rewarding, and child care is extremely important to our families out there. Also, welfare reform and making sure that our least vulnerable are being taken care of important to me. Thank you.
I'm Carolyn McElpatrick from District 3B, which is a portion of Itasca County and all of Aiken County, so a little bit up north. I am a registered nurse, retired, most recently having worked in clinical drug trials for the National Health Institute. I am interested in reform as well and have special interest also in nursing home and with the disabled.
I'm Mike Benson, representative for District 30B, which is a portion of Rochester, Olmsted, and Wabasha counties. I'm on the Reform Committee, and I'm interested in nursing care and long-term care, I guess, because I'm in the middle of the baby boom and beginning to think about those issues.
Hi, I'm Joe McDonald, a new freshman from Delano in the Wright County, so I represent several cities in 19B. I'm a professional photographer. I have a studio in downtown Delano that I will be continuing to shoot as I continue to legislate. It's an honor to be here, and I'm anxious to work hard on the Reform and Finance Committee in the Health and Human Services to ensure that those who are in most need get our love and compassion and all the help that they can in a fiscally responsible manner. So it's an honor to be here, and I'm anxious to work with all of you good folks.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bob Barrett. I am a member of the HHS Reform Committee. I represent the good folks of District 17B, Chisago County, Lindstrom, Wyoming, North Branch, Taylor's Falls, Chisago City. My background, I work at a drug and alcohol treatment facility in Minnesota and a nonprofit publisher of materials related to drug and alcohol addiction. So my passion is for drug and alcohol addiction recovery. There are 20 million people in our country addicted to drugs and alcohol. 2 million people get helped. The 18 million that aren't being helped, there's a tremendous cost to our society. Regardless of our thoughts on who pays for those costs, that's a fact. There is a tremendous cost. But my background is in finance and accounting. analysis. And one of the former CEOs of our company once said, we have to do well as a company. We have to do well to do good. And so as a company, we are a company, we need to do well so that we can do well, do good for our people. I'm also the treasurer of my church, have been for many, many years, and what I've been saying at every quarterly meeting when we have a meeting is when the treasurer speaks longer and more often than the pastor, you have an issue. And I think that bodes well for our committee as well. We shouldn't be about money, but we are because we have a problem. So I'd like to help solve that financial problem so we can get on with the business of helping the folks in Minnesota. Thank you very much. I also want to say one thing, Mr. Chair. I do need to leave at 1:30 for a while. I'm double booked on committee meetings. I want to let you know. It's not because I don't care. It's I have to check in at least with the other committee, but I will be back.
That'll only happen once.
It will. Thank you.
Representative Glenn Grunagen, I'm from House District 25A. That's Le Sueur County and Eastern Sibley County. I'm on the Health Reform Committee. I have a strong interest in health care reform. I've been in the health care insurance industry for over 30 years. I ran on one of my primary planks was lower premiums and better access to health care. I believe the private sector solutions will produce those types of results. The other thing I just state is if anybody participating in this, I think, should review the state demographer's report of November 2009, I believe. Tom Gillespie, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And in there, it shows that the demographics, which we're all aware of, are changing dramatically. And with the rising health care costs, if we don't correct that and change that, it is going to use up all additional money to the state, and there will be no additional revenue either for public education, higher education, or roads or bridges. That's the type of crisis that we're facing. It is not a short-term solution. It's a long-term structural solution. So we need to come up with long-term structural changes. So I completely agree with Chairman Abler's assessment on the fact that it needs to be long-term solutions. The other principle I firmly believe in, that government is one of the most inefficient and expensive ways to deliver any product or service. We need to look to the private sector and to our charities and incentivize giving to them to meet the needs that are out there. Government cannot afford to do that continually. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Representative Kathy Lohmer, and I'm from 56A, which is northern part of Woodbury, southern part of Stillwater, and all of the eastern communities in between. There's actually 10 communities that I represent. And I'm part of the freshman class here, so I'm new and I'm interested in learning a lot. I do have 4 children, and my oldest has a disability and has had over 70 surgeries, so I'm very interested in the whole health care system and taking care of the disabled and making sure, as Representative Grunhagen said, that we have the resources that we can care for the people that really need to be cared for. And I'm also very interested in the elderly, so thank you.
Representative Tom Huntley from 7A, which is the eastern third of the city of Duluth, and I'm on both the Health and Human Services Policy Committee and the Finance Committee, and I've been on both of those for a number of years.
I'm Representative Mary Kiffmeyer, and I represent 16B, Sherburne County, Big Lake, Clear Lake, Becker, Zimmerman, kind of areas like that. And this is my second term, and I am again on Health and Human Services Finance and glad to be on Representative Gutwalt's Reform Committee as well. I'm a registered nurse and a former hospital district board member. But financially, we want to recognize that we want to take care of the essentials. But in order to do that, we also have to be able to pay for those. And I think the issue is going to be more the reform of how they're delivered and how they're paid for, not that they are not cared for or taken care of, and those things that are the essentials. So I think that's what the committee is about. I'm looking forward to that work and looking forward to here to serving with also Senator Han. Glad to have you here. And it's good to see the three of you here working together and having that focus. It's a very important issue. So thank you.
My name is Holly Iverson Hayden, and I am the City Administrator for the Health and Human Services Reform Committee.
State Representative Steve Gottwald, I represent District 15A, which includes St. Cloud Way Park, St. Augusta, and Rockville in the central part of our state, and I'm also chairing the Health Care Reform Committee. so named because that's exactly what we're going to focus on. And as you've heard around the table here, we need, it reminds me of the old definition of insanity, expecting different results from doing the same thing over and over again. We can't keep doing the same thing over and over again if we're going to meet the challenges that we're facing. I'll have more opportunity to talk when we have the Reform Committee convening at 2:30. So yeah. With that.
Thank you. I think we have four pages here. Right? No, I mean four pages. if somebody can kind of elbow the... Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, let's just introduce... Yeah, say hello and tell us where you're from. And are there two others? Yeah.
I'm Karen Brunelson. I'm also a first-year page, a registered nurse. This is my very early interest.
Is that all we have? All right.
My name is Bill Thayer.
Oh, okay.
First-year page. It's an honor and privilege to be here.
Well, welcome. Welcome to the pages. They work really hard. We have some staff who works hard that are hiding in the front row there. They can stand up and say something. Thank you.
Danielle Pinelli from House Research, and I work on long-term care and the income assistance programs.
I'm Randy Chun, also with House Research, work mainly with state programs and healthcare acquisitions.
Hello, I'm Christina Pearson, and I'm working on the House Republican Research for the Healthcare Reform Section of the Committee.
Hi, I'm Emily Adrian. Fiscal staff, and I'll cover the health department and the health-related boards.
Okay, so just to brag on our house staff. We have really good house staff, Senator. I've become they are for the freshmen. These staffers know a lot, the partisan research staff is quite capable. I know from anyway, but the content knowledge that the nonpartisan staff has is remarkable, and if you have a good idea, they can tell you if it might actually work, and if they say it might not work, you want to take that advice. So it's good to have them there. Well, I think we're ready for the department to come do our presentation, and I don't know how we'll meter the time out, and so maybe they'll go through some things. If you have questions. I don't mind questions, but I think they should be allowed to go a little while just to kind of cover some stuff. And maybe if you want to, Chuck, if I don't know if you're taking the lead or if you just want to kind of take a couple minutes and then find an obvious break point for questions, or however you want to do it. I'd like it to be comprehensible because there's a mass. Well, you know, if you'd hold up which document you're looking at, I think there's more than four pages there.
Looking at this document, folks, if you can find that, should be in your package for the hearing today. Mr. Chair, I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. Happy to be here today and for the opportunity to share with the committee, the two committees, as well as Senator Han, the overview of the Department of Human Services. I'm going to start by giving you a very high-level overview of the department's budget, where the money goes. We're going to talk some about growth and what's been driving growth in human services. We're going to talk about the MA expansion, how that is budgeted. And Mr. Hoffman is going to walk you through the forecast, as Chair Abler suggested. Ms. Vogt from MMB will take you through the Healthcare Access Fund and what that looks like. And then we'll end with Ms. Rankin, our budget director for DHS, taking into three topics that Chair Abler asked us to cover: the shifts that affect Health and Human Services, the unallotments, and the stimulus, in detail around how the stimulus has impacted our budget. So that's what we have available for you for the next couple of hours here or longer as we go. I'll start with the first page. This gives you a high-level overview of the budget for the Department of Human Services over the last four biennia plus the projection going into 12 and 13. The top part of this shows the direct appropriated funds. The largest of that is obviously the general fund, but also you'll find work in this committee, a lot of work around the Healthcare Access Fund. That's the second fund listed here, HCAF, that's Healthcare Access Fund. That is also a state fund that is derived from provider taxes, which goes largely to fund Minnesota Care and a few other activities. The next fund that's listed under the direct funding is the TANF fund. This is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. This is a federal block grant. It is federal money, but it's direct appropriator, so it shows here as a state resource. And then two smaller funds, the State Government Special Revenue and the Lottery Fund, which the department gets small amounts of money for particular purposes. You can see, if you're looking there, then at the direct appropriated state funds growth over time in Department of Human Services. We started out at around $8 billion organization in the 04-05 biennium, and the forecast for 12 and 13 would have that at $13.6 billion. The second row down from that, you see then this little table that's down below, adds in the federal funds. This is very important. Most of the services that are delivered through DHS have a federal share that's involved in them. The large bulk of this is through the medical assistance program. The federal government shares 50% or sometimes a little bit more, depending on if there's some incentives in place, as there were with the stimulus, of the cost of medical assistance. Those dollars, of course, are also part of our budget. DHS is the second largest general fund budget in the state, behind K-12. We're the largest if you look at all funds. If you put the federal funds into the picture, more is spent through Health and Human Services than through education or any of the other departments or areas of the budget within HHS or within state of Minnesota. One of the things that you'll note in looking at this, we put in the percent change biennium to biennium numbers. And if you look at the top, which represents the state funds, you'll see some growth in the first two biennium there, and then a drop in 10-11, and then a very large increase going into 12 and 13. That's what the stimulus funds did in terms of the representation. You can see this if you look below at the percent change for all funds, including federal funds, you'll see that that gets smoothed out. Essentially, the federal stimulus funds in the current biennium we're in for 10 and 11 replaced a lot of general fund spending that would have otherwise taken place. So we had more federal money we were spending and less state money, but overall we were spending about the same amount of money, in course, with this increase we've seen over time. And as I mentioned, Ms. Rankin will take you into more detail on the stimulus later in the hearing to give you a better picture of where those dollars were and what the impact was on the DHS budget. The next page shows you a pie chart. This shows you where the dollars in Health and Human Services in the Department of Human Services go. And this again is the direct appropriation dollars. The very, very large blue piece there is the medical assistance program. Minnesota's version of the Medicaid program accounts for 59% of the spending that we do in DHS. That is about 28% of those dollars go to the health care for families and kids. The remaining 72% goes to the elderly and disabled in terms of basic care or long-term care, be it institutional or home and community-based. We also represent two blocks here of other forecaster programs, the Minnesota Care Program, which is a full 10% of our budget. The other forecaster programs that are here in green are largely the public assistance programs, the programs that deliver cash assistance to low-income elderly and disabled people. And then you'll see the purple shaded piece here are grant programs, and these are different than the forecaster programs. For those that are new to this work, forecasted programs are programs that essentially the legislature defines the eligibility, the benefits, if appropriate, the rates that will be paid as part of that program, for example, in a healthcare program. And then we forecast, Mr. Hoffman and his team forecast the cost of that program, and that forecast is carried as the cost that goes into the budget and goes into the future budget as we're forecasting forward, influenced by the economy, influenced by changes in the cost of healthcare, influenced by changes in the mix of people that we're serving, depending on what's going on within individual programs. Those are the largest and the fastest growing programs within DHS. The grant programs that are listed here, or shown here in the purple slot, are a relatively small part of what we do. Those are fixed appropriated programs where the legislature appropriates a dollar amount, money that goes to counties, to nonprofits, to other folks in the community to deliver various services based on an appropriation that we've been provided by the legislature. State-operated services, which accounts for 4% of our budget. This we used to call the state hospital part of the budget, the regional treatment centers. Those organizations don't exist in the same way anymore. It is a collection of services that are out in the community, focused on adult mental health, focuses well on services to people with developmental disabilities. This is essentially, in the mental health side, the safety net services. Includes a security hospital in St. Peter for people who are civilly committed for being mentally ill and dangerous. Central office operations, essentially the administrative component, the bureaucracy of DHS, is about 3% of our overall budget. And then the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which is 1% of the budget. This is for the civilly committed sex offenders, which is part of the DHS budget. And then technical activities, which are 1%, and this is a largely federal dollars that pass through DHS on their way, usually to counties for reimbursements for various programs that counties run. The next page that you'll see, which provides all the detail, is behind the pie chart you just looked at. This provides you, by budget activity, the base appropriation for 10 and 11 biennium for each of the areas that make up the DHS budget. And in correspondence with the pie chart we just looked at, the central office administrative appropriation operations is at the top here. The five areas of DHS, each with their own direct appropriation. And then as we looked at earlier as well, the forecasted programs, you can see the number jumping out on medical assistance of $5.8 billion in the medical assistance budget, as well as over $1 billion in Minnesota Care, the two big ones that are there. And then the other public assistance programs, the first four or five that are listed there, the cash assistance programs, as well as the child care, which is associated with the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's our program for families and kids, as well as lower on here, the alternative care program, which is for seniors, and also chemical dependency entitlement grants. That's a little bit of an anomaly in the budget system. It shows as a zero here. There is an appropriation to that program. It's about $190 million for the biennium in 10 and 11. That actually gets transferred into a special revenue fund, so it shows up as zero here. We have it tracked way down at the bottom. If you look, we've included that back in. It's a similar sort of transfer for major systems, about $75 million, which is also captured down there. The next listing there, then, are the grant programs that I mentioned. You can see they vary in size. These are, a lot of these are programs where the grants are made out to local nonprofits, to communities, to counties, to deliver various services. A lot of the services that we deliver, whether it's in the families area or in disabilities or other areas, the medical assistance, the forecaster programs provide some level of support. A lot of the grant programs provide the community side of that, the support for the community services and services that are provided in the community. These are, most of you, I believe, have received from the Department of Management and Budget your base budget book, which has narratives which describe each of these, as well as the fiscal detail for each of these programs. That's a great resource to go to try to figure out what's inside of some of these. Particularly with these grant programs, there are a lot of small pieces that are within what you see here in the appropriation. And then toward the bottom, we have the state-operated services, which I mentioned earlier, as well as the sex offender program and the technical activities. And you can see that adds up to, when you put back in the two pieces that are transferred out, a little over $10 billion for 10-11.
This is a good time for a question. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And question on the first page. We talked about the $25 billion of direct appropriations from the federal funds. Does the state legislature have any say over those funds at all?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I think the $25 million is actually the total. It's $11 billion would be the federal piece of that if you're looking out at the fiscal years 12 and 13.
Thank you. And so my question then on the $11 billion, do we have any say on how those dollars are spent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, yes, those dollars are spent as part of programs that are, most part, as programs that are state-federal controlled, like the medical assistance program. The legislature sets the policy around medical assistance. We then go forward and spend the state money, draw down the federal money as part of that, but it's all anticipated as part of setting and establishing the budget. Similarly, some programs like the TANF block grant related to the MFIP program, or the child care development block grant related to child care programs. The legislature has direct role in how those federal funds are used as part of funding Minnesota's version of that program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. And you're getting some information. These are from me, these two articles. And that was part of my opening comments about how the lay of the land has changed a bit. And these are from in the same day in the newspaper. On one article, they was the federal issues with the health reform, we'll call it that. Those are the names for it. We'll surely use those too later, I suppose. But some of the federal Republicans are not at all fans of that, and they want to repeal it at the earliest possible chance. Some of those same legislators, for good, bad, or indifferent, don't want to raise the debt limit. And so whatever you think of that, this is going on. And so that just, to the topic of federal funds, makes me personally wonder about how many of those will keep flowing and how readily those will be available to build our programs. And well, that'll be discussed more. Representative Slawick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, we've worked together quite a bit. I have two things. One, some of us don't have colors, so we're in black and white. So when you say purple, some of us can't track. So just so you know that. And secondly, so I'm trying to just pull out, okay, grant programs. It says 9% on your first chart, and then you go down and list them individually on the second page. But is there a total anywhere by subcategory so we could figure out the percentages and how much the dollar category that goes along with that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, first I apologize. I didn't know you didn't have colors. I think that's our last colored slide, so hopefully it's the last point of confusion.
Thank you.
No, we don't have those put in here. I could generate that for you so that you could see what the dollar amounts are associated with each piece.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would like to see that because one thing that comes under fire a lot, and I think will come under fire this session, are those grant programs and just how much money is that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Are there any other questions? Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I do have a question. Just to inform, in terms of helping me out, page 3 there, we have a listing of all the programs. It would be nice at some point, being new and not knowing a lot about this area, to actually have a second column or third column showing how many people are being served by those dollars and what actually is being contributed to that person's to improve the quality of their life. That would give me a little bit extra context to dollar per recipient and some other things that could help me understand where we need to keep and what we need to cut.
Just the staff tells me that it's been premeditated, and you'll see that the week of the 18th.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. Well, with that, I need to go to my other meeting.
Have a good meeting.
I'll be back.
Yeah, give my regards. They'll wish they were here, I'm sure. Any other questions while we're taking a little lull here? And just so you know, we'll be taking a break about 2:15, and then we'll come back about 2:30, I think. So if you're planning your phone calls or whatever. Mr. Johnson, proceed.
Mr. Chair, if there aren't any more questions on these three pages, I'm going to ask Mr. Hoffman to take us through a next section where we look at a little bit more detail on the programs and particularly where the growth has been over the last several years within the human services budget.
Mr. Hoffman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. the next page has some terms on it. When we talk about these programs, there's a lot of confusion on the part of the public about three different names that start with M. And so I thought it was a good idea. In fact, we sometimes use this as an interview question for people who ought to know these things very thoroughly. The Medicaid name is the name of the federal program. It's a means-tested program operated in cooperation with the states. Each state has its own version of the program within the limits set by the federal law and regulations. So states vary up to what income levels they cover and what kinds of services they cover within certain limits as set by the federal government. It's a program that covers much of the long-term care which is provided in this country, and it covers basic medical care. Typically, as is the case in Minnesota, the overwhelming majority of the people enrolled in the program are children and caretakers and pregnant women, and they get basic medical coverage. And that coverage is relatively cheap compared to the cost of long-term care and compared to the cost of covering the elderly and the disabled. The Medicare program is a federal medical program, does not involve the state in the administration of it, which covers elderly and disabled people. It is not means tested. You don't have to be poor to get on Medicare, or you don't have to meet income standards. It has a very limited long-term care coverage because it only, and there's a typo here, only rehabilitative care. If you have elderly relatives, you may have encountered the situation where they're hospitalized, they go into a rehab facility, and Medicare only covers them for a short time until the rehab is done. If it turns into custodial care, Medicare doesn't pay for it anymore. So in Minnesota, Medicare pays for something like 7 or 8% of the long-term care costs, nursing costs.
You want to take a question? Is this do you want to go a little bit, or do you want to? How is it going to work for questions?
I'd be happy to follow the chair's lead.
So just Representative McDonald, go ahead. Do you want to?
Mr. Chair, George, just a quick question. Pardon my preschool question here. However, I'm in a learning stage. When you say not means tested, and you don't have to be poor to get this coverage, will it apply to anyone that has millionaires? They get this opportunity as well, or at what level do you define what poor is, or you can't afford this kind of coverage for Medicare?
Mr. Hoffman.
In the case of Medicare, there is no test. It is not means tested. Anybody, regardless of how much income or wealth they have, can qualify for Medicare based on their age and their quarters of work or their disability status and quarters of work.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hosh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to point out that most Minnesota programs are means tested. Medicare is completely federal. So,
thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I'm down around the corner here. Wasn't quite sure. Thank you. I think probably the other thing, though, is Medicare is one of the programs that we pay into, as Representative Huntley said to me, for about 40 years before you get it. So it is a paid-in program, and I think that makes a difference. And many times those who are on the poverty level don't always have the means to pay in to Medicare, though they do at times. So I just thought that would be helpful to add to the mix, that it's not means-tested, but it is means-paid.
Okay, Mr. Hoffman, why don't you continue on?
Mr. Chairman, medical assistance is Minnesota's name for its version of the Medicaid program. And something important to understand about the medical assistance program is that it has categorical eligibility. You have to fall into certain categories in order to be eligible for the medical assistance program. You have to be age 65 or over. You have to be disabled or blind according to the disability definition of the supplemental security income program. Or a child, and the state chooses this age. In Minnesota, it's under 21. It can be under 19 in other states. Or you have to be the parent or the custodial caretaker of a child under 21, or a pregnant woman. Now, if you think about who is covered, you can infer who is not covered, and that is a non-disabled, non-elderly person, non-pregnant person, who is not a custodial caretaker, who is between the ages of 21 and 64. That's the group that is not covered by the historical medical assistance program or Medicaid. A lot of people think if you're poor enough, you will be covered by the Medicaid program, and that is not the case because of the categorical eligibility of the program. And partly, I'm telling you this so you can understand the context of the Medicaid expansion, which is in the federal law now. It's an expansion to that group, the non-disabled, non-elderly adult who is not a custodial parent. That's who is covered under the expansion. And the expansion is mandatory come January of 2014. Earlier expansion is optional for each state's Medicaid program. And as long as I mentioned it, supplemental security income is a federal income support program for elderly and disabled individuals. It is different. You have to have a low enough income to qualify for this program, and then it'll supplement your income up to, I think, $600 and some per month. So you have to be pretty low income. It is distinct from what everybody calls Social Security, which is the retirement and the disability program, which you don't have to be poor to get. You don't have to have income under a certain level in order to get Social Security. You do in order to get supplemental security income. From there, we'll go to a sort of bird's eye view.
Mr. Hoffman, can I interrupt one second? I think we have a question from Representative Huntley. I am temporarily acting as chairman as Representative Aber had to step out. I don't know if that's even legal to do, but at any rate, I'm doing it, and Representative Huntley.
Senator Hahn, we're not voting, so I don't think anything makes too much difference. I would just tell the members that the SS is a federal determination, and they determine whether the individual meets that criteria, and we don't have too much to do with that. And the trouble with that is, I'll give you an example. There's a gentleman down in St. Paul today from Duluth that has seven different chronic illnesses and basically has spent most of the last 2 years living on the street. He's been trying for 57 months to get the federal classification of SSI. And so we have made an effort in this state to try to speed that process up, and we've hired state employees to help these people get classified by the feds. But it is a major problem for us because these people are clearly disabled and cannot work, but the feds drag their feet and drag their feet and drag their feet.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman. I'm sorry, one other question. Yes, Representative Visit Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I'm just asking for a clarification from the folks from DHS, and I don't know if this is easy to do. So if this is easy to do, after you talk about sort of the programs and who's eligible, it might be helpful for us to hear you talk about, okay, for the elderly in Minnesota, these are the programs that, you know, sort of go crosswise across. So for the elderly in Minnesota, there's Medicare, there's Medicaid, there's SSI. For the disabled in Minnesota, there's, so you see both the population that's by program, but also the programs by population. I don't know if that would be hard, but that would be helpful for me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy,
Mr. Johnson.
I think that we could probably do that. We can't, not prepared to do that here today. We're just trying to cover budget. I think Mr. Hoffman's trying to orient to some terms so you can understand some of the forecasts. But yes, we could look at how to put something together that would help you understand that crossways look.
Thank you. And Mr. Hoffman, before I ask you to proceed, I think we have one other question from Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, you know, I was in a meeting with one of the local hospitals that is considering merging with the Mayo system in my district. So they're members of the Mayo and also from the local hospital. And one of the things they brought up was that the hospitals lose money on all four government programs, Minnesota Care, GAMC, Medicaid, and also Medicare. And they make up for those losses by cost shifting to private insurance, group and individual, about, on this particular illustration, was about 42%. So our individual and group premiums are approximately 40% higher or more because of the cost shifting, because of the loss of the government programs in administering those services. Now, Chuck and John,
George.
I'll get it right next time. You know, you've got a lot of experience in that area. And, you know, from your perspective, what are driving these costs? Because the differential between government revenues and the revenues hospitals and doctors need in order to meet their expenses seems to be widening. In other words, it's getting worse and worse. So, therefore, there's more and more cost shifting to the private sector, which is, you know, higher costs in the private sector are driving more and more uninsureds. What can we do to rectify that situation where the revenues from the government programs more closely meet the needed dollars for the hospitals and the doctors? And I mean by that not more money, but how can we bring those costs down some way? Any insight if you were king for a day?
Mr. Hoffman, just hang on a second. I just did. See, I leave, and the Senate can't even maintain decorum. And it's our custom in the House to call our witnesses Mr. or Ms. or something.
So oh, okay.
It's, and they are, because we just do that, because that's...
Using the last name or the first name?
Last name.
Well,
last.
See, in the Senate, our custom is to call people my lord or my...
Oh. So which are we using,
thank you.
Mr. or my lord?
So, thank you. So... We have a lot of material to cover about the forecast, and I think that if we just limit our questions to forecast-related questions, there will be plenty of opportunity for that question to come up in the Reform Committee and in bills you'll be carrying. So I think just pass on that question, and we better get back onto our... is there any other questions about the forecast? Okay, let's proceed, Mr. Hoffman. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the next page, there are some tables, and page 5... has a breakout of the major parts of the medical assistance program and shows expenditures, total expenditures, state and federal dollars over a period of 10 years, and calculates annual percent change and average percent change over that time. And so the first block with an A at the top is long-term care facilities. Most of this money is paid for nursing home care. A smaller piece of it is ICFMRs, group homes for people with developmental disabilities. And if you look at the trend in this part of medical assistance, you see it's a downward expenditure trend. And this is because the number of people in nursing homes, and it's true in total as well as the number on medical assistance in nursing homes, that number has been going down fairly steadily over the years, over recent years anyway. And the same is true of ICFMR. The number of ICFMR beds has been going down. And so that's the reason, even though there has been some increase over the years in what we pay for a unit of service, the overall expenditures have been going down at an average pace of 1.75% per year. Now, the next block kind of tells you where those people are going. They're going into the various alternative services that we offer in the medical assistance program. And the largest one as far as expenditures is the waiver for people with developmental disabilities as a short term. We call it DD waiver. Another large waiver is elderly waiver. These services, we have five of them. We have five categories of what we call home and community-based waivers. They are called waivers because they are arrangements with the federal government under which the state can pay for services not normally covered by a Medicaid program as an alternative to institutional service for a person. So under each of these waivers, there are individualized service packages that offer supportive services to individuals who are at risk of being placed in an institution. Now, elderly waiver is an alternative to nursing facility or nursing home placement for people 65 and older. DD waiver is an alternative to placement in an ICFMR. We have gotten to the point where we have more people in the alternatives than we have in the institutional placements. So we have nearly 22,000 in elderly waiver. We have 18,000 we are paying for in nursing homes, and we have 15,000 in the DD waiver. We have only 1,400 people in ICFMRs. That is the nature of these services. There are three other home and community-based waivers. One is traumatic brain injury. One is a small one for only a few hundred people in it for children who would otherwise be in an inpatient hospital setting. And the third is another larger one. It's alternative to nursing home placement for people under the age of 65. So what if you look at the expenditure trend here, it's been going expenditures have been going up 8% a year. Now, and we also calculated a total of the two, of the institutional services and the waiver services, and when you look at the combination, the average trend over time is approaching 5% increase in expenditures. So that's sort of a bird's eye view of the rate of growth in spending on. This is the long-term care services part of the medical assistance program.
Members have questions about? Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, just to be clear about this, if we were to get rid of all our waiver programs, the theory at least is that our costs would then go up, correct? Because the people who are on these programs are there as an alternative to institutional care, which would be much more expensive in most cases.
Mr. Hoffman.
Well, to start with, we can't get rid of those programs because they come under a maintenance of effort requirement from the federal government connected with the enhanced funding that the federal government gave to the state, is giving to the state in the economic stimulus period, which is it started in 2009. It's going to end at the end of June of of the current year. And in the 10-11 biennium, as has been implied, the federal government gave us enhanced funding of almost $1.5 billion in the medical assistance program. And a string attached to that, the reason the federal government did this is it wanted to discourage the states from all slashing their Medicaid programs in order to save money just when enrollment was going up because of the economy. And it was part of the stimulus package because they knew that if the states slashed their Medicaid programs, it would not help the economy. And so that was the rationale of the stimulus. But one of the strings attached to that is that the state is not allowed for a period of time to change eligibility in its Medicaid program. And specifically attached to home and community-based waivers, we have to continue serving as many people as we were serving in March of 2010. And so we have a requirement that we can't cut the number of people we serve in home and community-based waivers under the March 2010 level. Now, to get back to the other question, the federal government has a cost neutrality requirement attached to home and community-based waivers, and the requirement is that the per capita cost of persons served under the waiver be no higher than the per capita cost for a year of people served in the institutional setting. Now, that's not a budget neutrality. That's a kind of technical cost neutrality at the person level. And the federal government set that rule to put some kind of limits on what we spent. But we know that we don't get a one-for-one. We know that for 100 more people that we serve in a home and community-based waiver, we don't get a reduction of 100 people in institutional services. So it's not a simple question to answer, and if we serve fewer people in home and community-based waivers, it won't necessarily cost us money.
Representative Liebing, does that help you?
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions on this part? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Hand. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hoffman, just I want to clarify one thing. I think you were saying, I'm not clear if I heard it, and then ask you a further question related. But you've talked about the breakout, the difference between the number of folks that are in, say, nursing homes versus being covered by elderly waivers. Is there any figures that show the cost per person between those two? In other words, if you were going to do a rough estimate, say, well, it costs us X to have a person in a nursing home, or at least in state funds, versus X or Y in under waivered services, home services. Is there a way to compare that? My sense is from looking at the numbers, it looks like it's more expensive to do waivered services, but I'm not sure if that's tracking exactly because there are different components here. Do you have an answer for that?
I do have some summary information, and I can point people to where they can find it in greater detail. But in the current year, we expect to be covering about 18,000 people in nursing homes, and the cost of the nursing home coverage is about the net cost to the medical assistance program. is about $3,800 a month. The average cost per month of the elderly waiver is about $1,200 a month. And so elderly waiver is distinctly cheaper per person than it is to pay for nursing home care. And if we look at the other program, alternative to nursing home placement for people under 65, the average cost of that waiver service is about $2,600 a month. So it's not as advantageous as elderly waiver, but it is still cheaper than the cost of nursing home care.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. One other question on your sheet here on page 5, you've got the different components here, and you mentioned that you have a little paragraph explanation for growth. They all say that it's roughly 50% is increase in eligibility or the number of people receiving the services, and then roughly half is increases in the cost of care in the elderly and disabled basic care at 60%. But my question is, when you talk about increases in cost of care, what are the drivers? What are the cost drivers that cause that half of that cost to go up across all these programs?
Mr. Hoffman.
In the case of nursing facility care, it's basically change in rates. Nursing facility care is a very clearly defined service. We know exactly what it is. We set rates per day. There is a little bit of change in the composition of the population. It tends to get a little more severe, but the main reason for the change in the cost of nursing home care is the change in rates. And in Minnesota, it's a captive industry basically, and the legislature and the governor make the rates for all those nursing homes, which is almost all of them, who choose to participate in the medical assistance program. In the home and community-based waivers, it's a different situation because it's an individual package of service. And here we have historically sometimes allowed cost of living increases in rates. In the 09 session, we had what some of us started calling an UNCOLA, which was a negative change in rates. But the major factor that leads to increase here is change in the mix of services, especially change in the proportion of people who are getting 24-hour supervision in something. It's supposed to be home-like, but it may be home-like with shift staff offering 24-hour supervision. That kind of service is much more expensive. So as you get more people in that kind of service, it drives up the average cost of the waiver service.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Any other questions? Why don't you proceed and continue on?
Okay, the next two blocks are the basic care parts of the program. The long-term care part that we just looked at is only the long-term care services. It's not all the services for the people in long-term care. It's not the basic medical coverage. And so on the left side and the bottom, elderly and disabled basic care, this is the basic medical coverage for the elderly people, currently about 58,000 enrollees. Almost all are on Medicare, and so we act like a Medicare supplement. We pay for what Medicare does not pay for. In the case of the disabled, which is approaching 110,000 currently, about half are on Medicare. So for about half, we act again like a Medicare supplement. For the other half, we pay the full cost of health care under our rates.
And here, if you look at the trend over the years, trend in expenditures over the years, it's been an average of about 6.5% increase. This was helped a little bit. It would be a little bit higher if it were not for the institution of Medicare Part D coverage of pharmacy, because in 2006 Medicare started paying for pharmacy, and so for all those people on Medicare, we basically, our program basically didn't have to pay for pharmacy anymore. Now that helped this expenditure trend, but the federal government put something into law that said we had to pay them back most of the savings from that. So there is another element of the medical assistance forecast under which we pay a monthly bill which we get from the federal government to help the federal government pay for the cost of Medicare Part D. And we are currently getting a bill of about $13 million a month. Now, in a sense, what they did was a fair representation of what we saved, and they're not taking all of it back. They're taking a high percentage that gets a little smaller each year, but it still means that we are having to pay the feds in the current year something like $170 million, which is part of the medical assistance forecast. It's worth mentioning because it's a part of the expenditure which we have no choice on. They send us a bill and we have to pay it.
Keep going.
Okay. Families and kids basic care. Here the trend has been higher. Average trend over the years, 10.8% through the end of the forecast period. You can see a little bit of indication in there that we get more enrollment when the economy is bad, and enrollment tends to fall some after the economy gets better. This, well, over a period of 2 years, under the recession, we picked up about 80,000 enrollees, almost a 20% increase in enrollment because of the economy. And this is basically basic medical care for mostly children. Most of the enrollees are children. Smaller numbers of caretakers and parents, and a modest number of pregnant women. We pay for about 30,000 births per year under this program. Those are the four major parts of the medical assistance program. Expenditure trends in the whole program over the years. If I look back 10 years, and I'm not including the forecast in this, looking from actual 2010, if I look back to 2000, I see expenditure increase of about 8.5% a year. If I look back 20 years, I see expenditure increase of about 8.5% a year. It's in the last 5 years, the growth has been a bit less. If you look at the last 5 years, it's been an increase of about 7% a year. But it goes up and down, because if I look back 15 years, it's also 7% a year. So it all depends on the time frame of what you look at. But we have seen steady growth. We have seen steady growth between 7 and 9% a year in expenditures, in spite of many efforts over the years to find ways to hold down the cost of the program.
Okay, we'll keep going. We're going to quit in about 11 minutes, so you can get as far as you can get, and we'll take a break.
I can go on to the cash assistance programs in that time,
yeah,
on the next page?
Please do. That'd be great. Okay. And members, just to help you understand, these numbers, if you digest these all in one reading, I'm really impressed with your prowess. Representative Huntley, I'm still figuring these out, and I'm sure you're. But so this is meant to be an exposure to this material. You'll go home and look at it over the weekend. And every one of these topics will be dissecting a bit in some detail. Not deep detail, but in some detail as you go in the next couple of weeks. But you have to get the big picture to know what those details mean. So, Mr. Hoffman, please continue.
Okay. On page 6, Minnesota Family Investment Program, we've actually had a negative expenditure trend in this program over the years. We currently have about 43,000 cases on the program, 43,000 families. And those families contain about 117,000 people. So it's an average of not quite 3 individuals per family. And this is the cash part of the program. It's a combined benefit of cash and food, but the food part comes from the federal food stamp program, the name of which, for reasons that I don't understand, has been changed to SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. General assistance offers, if you have no income, offers a grant of $200 per month, approximately. We have 21,000 people on this program. We have had a pretty steady growth in the number of people on this program each year in recent years, and that is basically the reason for the expenditure growth, because the benefits have not changed. We have not been able to figure out why we are steadily seeing more people who can qualify for a program that will only give you $200 a month. The Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program is a supplement to the SSI program. Not everybody who's on SSI gets this supplement. It's a subset of the people on the SSI program. We currently have about 30,000 people on the program, and they get an average benefit of $100 a month. The group residential housing program is a program that serves elderly and disabled people who the counties place in a group housing setting. We currently have 18,000 people on this program. Most of them are also SSI recipients. And the fact that they get an SSI grant holds down the state cost of the program, because they have to apply the SSI grant to the cost of the housing. And the average cost, which is paid by the program for this coverage, is approximately $590 a month.
Questions? I guess keep going.
That's the nutshell view of our program. Representative Slavik will miss any mention of child care,
which is, yeah, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick question then: could a person be eligible for all three, for instance, the MFIP plus the GA plus the MSA?
Mr. Hoffman.
MFIP is a program for children and their caretakers. And general assistance, the The short answer is you can't be eligible for MFIP and either of the others. General assistance is for individuals without children in the family. The group residential housing, some people who are in the group residential housing program who don't get an SSI grant will get a personal needs grant from the general assistance program. So if I'm on SSI and I'm in one of those places, I get to keep approximately $90 out of the SSI grant each month, and the rest is applied to the cost of housing. If I'm not getting SSI, but I'm in one of those settings, I'm somebody eligible for the general assistance program, and the general assistance program gives me the $90 personal needs, and the housing cost is paid by the group residential housing program. Otherwise, there is no overlap in the eligibility.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to point out, because this can be overwhelming with all the different programs and amounts, but if you look at the amounts in this page that we're looking at, you could completely eliminate all these programs, 100% of them, not have them anymore, and we'd still have a $5.71 billion deficit.
This is math,
yes,
to me, so thank you.
Well, it's helpful. It just shows that where the money's at and the gravity of the situation we're in.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, if you have a family and one of the kids is on SSI and the family's eligible for MFIP, the child could still be getting the SSI. Is that correct?
Mr. Hoffman?
A child or a parent could be getting SSI.
Representative, help me.
And then how do we treat it for the MFIP grant?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, the SSI is, I believe, currently not counted for the basis of determining the MFIP grant. I'm getting a nod, that's correct.
Okay.
We have had policies in the past where we counted a portion of it that was then repealed, I'm not sure when, a couple of years ago.
Thank you. We're going to take a break in 3 minutes. Mr. Hoffman, are you familiar? You gave me this. Do you know that this is in the packet?
I know that that's in the package, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Can you give us a one-minute orientation to that? And then also want to point out to members, this the text version of the forecast. I urge you to read this. This is very interesting. And this piece here, which is 80 pages, talks about the growth in programming. You can see a lot of it's very good math. Can you want to spend a minute talking about that?
Okay, the narrative document, which is this one, is a document about change in the forecast. We do a reforecast for the state's November forecast. We contribute a part of the expenditure forecast on our programs, and this document is a description of the new forecast and the change from the previous forecast. And so all the narrative is about forecast change, and the tables at the end show in a tabular form broken out what the new forecast is for each of many parts of the program and what the old forecast was and what the difference is in dollars and in percentage changes. So if just to give you a very bottom line figure, our general fund forecast went down about 2% in the November forecast. Most of that's in medical assistance. The other document, which is an informal document, and I said, Chair, Chair Abler is doing fiscal immersion. This is the first 5 or 6 pages are a display of the new forecast, the old forecast, and the changes in state dollars. That's up to page 5. So it's old forecast and new forecast. It matches the information in the narrative document. It might be a display which is handier for some purposes. After the first 5 pages, there is a lot of detail on the new forecast, what the new forecast is. Most of the detail is on the medical assistance program. So for example, each of the home and community-based waivers has a page in the detail. So, but you need some acquaintance with what all's there in order to make effective use of it. A very small number of people actually use this document, but now you've got it, and if you have questions about it, or if somebody wants some kind of coaching sessions on the detail of what's there, I would be happy to do that sometime.
And this is very productive. We're going to terminate the forecast part of our meeting, and then when we come back under Representative Gottwald's gavel, move into the other part of the agenda with the Healthcare Access Fund and its expansion discussions. But Mr. Hoffman, I think you'll be impressed with the backgrounds of some of our members that have come on board recently, as well as the veterans. A lot of them, a good number of our new members are small business owners, and they find themselves now being on the board of a very large corporation. Mr. Hoffman actually knows these numbers by heart, probably. But I thought it'd be productive to give this to you. Since you are on the Finance Committee and those members who are on the Reform Committee, now you can be happy you're not on the Finance Committee. But still, it's productive to know where the money goes. Because we separate, you know, reform and policy from the money, but they are integrated as closely as anything can be. And so especially productive on this one, just from the high level of it, to look at the growth over the years. And you'll be interested that in the early, this goes back into the 80s and 90s, I think, at least 90s in cases. 89 is in one of the cases. You can see where things have moved along, and you'll see evidence of our good work in getting people out of institutions, into the community, into a less confining circumstances they can actually have a better life. And Minnesota's been good at that. And that's part of the things we can be proud of in our work. So any last comments before we recess? Mr. Hoffman, Mr. Johnson, thank you. We're recessed until 2:30.
You're welcome. Members will call the meeting to order. We have a lot of material to pull through, and I'm kind of impressed actually that a number of our new members are not glazed over yet from the detail. That will come.
We disguise it well.
That will come eventually, but thought I would offer just a few opening comments as the chair of the HHS Reform Committee. As I mentioned earlier, reform is a significant change in language for the title of this committee for a reason, because as these numbers suggest, and as you'll hear as we continue this afternoon, we have a lot of work to do to change the path we're on if we want to continue keeping the promises that we've made. I've used the term before, making promises we can't keep with money we don't have, and that's something we desperately need to turn around if we're going to take care of people in need in Minnesota. And reform also because we're going to be looking for big ideas. This is our opportunity in the midst of crisis to look at new ways of doing things, to really kind of rethink how we're delivering services. We want to do that in a thoughtful way, but we also want to do it in an open-minded way. One thing I've mentioned to a number of people I've talked with so far is instead of saying why we can't do things, we'd like to be able to talk about how we can do things or how we can make them better or if there's a way we can do them in a manner that doesn't hurt people. But now is the time to think of bold ideas and the ways to restructure our health and human services programs so that they meet the needs of Minnesota now and into the future. We have a short-term problem, the $6.2 billion deficit that obviously HHS is going to have to contribute something toward in the final solution. But we also have a long-term structural deficit, as you'll hear, too, with some of the numbers. And so we have to start thinking long-term about the solutions. I think Representative Abler referred to that earlier. We'll have lots of opportunities to have further discussion along these lines, but I'm looking forward to this being a bipartisan conversation. I mean that genuinely. Reform ideas don't know any particular party or boundaries, and so we'll be looking for great ideas from around this table and from the people in this room who follow these matters very closely, deliver services to people in need. You have various constituencies you serve, and we need all those good ideas if we're gonna figure this out for the short term and the long term. And so I'm kind of humbled and honored to have the opportunity to chair this committee, but also looking forward to what we're going to bring to the table. And with that, Mr. Johnson, I think we'll continue with where we were.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We're going to turn now to talk about the early expansion of medical assistance in Minnesota. And then Ms. Vogt from MMB will come up and share information on the Health Care Access Fund. The expansion of medical assistance is authorized under the Federal Affordable Care Act. This is an expansion to the Adults Without Children group. As Mr. Hoffman noted earlier, that's a group that has historically not been categorically eligible for Medicaid and medical assistance in Minnesota. For the 45 years prior in the Medicaid program, they'd not been eligible. The federal law mandates that all states would take on the adult without children population up to 133% of the poverty line starting in January of 2014. So that's what the federal law requires to happen. And at that point, the federal government would pay 100% of the cost of that, although over time, a number of years, that goes down to 90%. I believe it's a 6 or 7 year period. The federal law also allows states to opt in earlier than the January 1st of 2014 date to the expansion of the Adults Without Children and choose an income eligibility level that would be below 133. Last year, the Minnesota legislature did something that was relatively unusual. I think I'm not sure it's ever happened in my time around here, and passed a law that basically created a contingency around the decision whether or not to expand in Minnesota earlier than the January of 14 date. And essentially that law gave both the governor at the time, who was Governor Plenty, and the new governor, who's now Governor Dayton, each having an option to exercise whether or not we wanted to take the early adoption. And as I'm sure folks are aware, Governor Dayton did take that option this morning and signed an executive order for Minnesota to move forward with the expansion of medical assistance. For Minnesota, that'll be at 75% of the poverty level for the individuals, adults without kids. The arrangement that was made last year at the end of session as part of the final budget solution did provide funding to pay for the early expansion of MA in the budget. That money is being held in the forecast. It was held in at the end of session, it was held for the entirety of the fiscal year 2011. With the November forecast, funding is being held from a January 1st date, so about a half a year's worth of the funding in this biennium. And it also, of course, shows in the November forecast for the future years the cost to Minnesota for the early expansion. I'm going to ask Mr. Hoffman to walk you through the fiscal aspects of this so you can understand the dollars that are involved and how it shows for Minnesota to take this expansion option.
If you turn to page 7 of the document we were looking at before, it has a description of the enrollment estimates for the expansion. As Mr. Johnson said, the early expansion is up to 75% of the poverty level. So we are forecasting, and we, for all of our enrollment forecasts, we forecast average monthly enrollment. And this is average monthly enrollment for a program starting January 1st. That's a bit of an artificial date that was used in the November forecast. It was a matter of negotiation between MMB and the legislative staff. So this is a projection for a program that would start January 1st. So there's
there's a half year, and the 33,000 total enrollment shown in fiscal 11 is 6 months of enrollment averaged over 12 months. So it's actually, if you did a 6 month average, it'd be 66,000, 67,000 average. And then the next year it gets up to 95,000. So that we're forecasting a transition from Minnesota Care of roughly 50,000 people, and that's going to take some time. And we're forecasting a GAMC population getting in there right at the start. And we're forecasting picking up additional people who would not be on either of those two programs, and that population is described as the from uninsured population. So that's additional enrollment that we think we would not see in our other programs. The from Minnesota Care enrollment represents people who we're forecasting would be in Minnesota Care if not for the expansion. So the effect on the Minnesota Care enrollment is these numbers with the opposite sign. That is, we're forecasting that in fiscal year 12, if we with this early expansion, we will see 50,000 people who would have been in Minnesota Care, but they're going to be in medical assistance instead. And then, since the requirement of the mandatory expansion starts in the middle of a fiscal year, we split fiscal year 14 into two parts, and are showing average enrollment for each of the 6 month periods. When we get to the mandatory expansion, that is mandatory at a higher income level, 133% of poverty. So that draws more people out of Minnesota Care, and it also picks up a larger population from uninsured who would not be on the other programs. And if you want to look at the dollar figures in the forecast, take the big document, 80-page document with all the numbers in it, and look at page 20. And that has the cost projections for the Medicaid expansion. And in 2014, we have split it into mandatory and early. Early is the enrollment and the service cost for the first half of the fiscal year, and mandatory is the service cost and enrollment for the second half of the year. It sums to 122,000 average enrollment for the year. That's the same, if you look back to the other document we were looking at, that's the same as the average of 108 for 6 months and 142,000 for the other 6 months.
Mr. Hoffman, we have a question from the committee. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just confused about where we are, what page we're on. I think some of us are kind of flipping through here trying to figure out.
We're on page 20, Representative Liebling, 20 in the large
the
bundle.
Big 80-page document.
Ah, thank you.
The immersion piece, yes. And then we're cross-referencing that with page 7 from the...
Yes.
The summary document.
Yeah, because page 7 has a breakout of the categories we are forecasting enrollment to come from. There is a little piece on page 20 of the number tables that says CD fund.
These are people who would otherwise be served under the CD fund at totally state cost and are being, and we're assuming are picked up by the expansion, and then we get a federal share of that cost. That's why that's shown as a separate piece. We do the same thing in all the basic care forecasts in medical assistance. There's an interaction, a fairly complicated interaction between the CD fund and medical assistance program. That's the basic story, Mr. Chair, on the numbers on the expansion.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I think, as we mentioned earlier, members, this is the point at which I think everybody's eyes start glazing over from the numbers. But if you have any questions, now would be the time to ask them. Bring it.
Me first? Okay.
Who wants to go first? Representative Grunhagen.
Okay. We'll go alphabetically. No, we won't. Mr. Chairman, why do I forget to keep Mr. Johnson?
Hoffman.
I'll get it right sooner or later. But on that page 20, it was just pointed out to me that the monthly average payment per individual, right? So in 2011, for that coverage, you're going to be paying $848.69. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, you know, again, I come from an insurance background. That means that to provide this service, the premium for an individual is $848.69. I mean, that just seems, I mean, that's, we've got bad health insurance rates in the private sector, you know, running $800 to $1,000 for a family. But here we're looking at $848, and it's going to go up under this program to $1,168 by 2015. You add to that the reimbursement rate of medical assistance is much worse than the private sector. And you basically have a situation where, and correct me if I'm wrong, extremely high cost, and then the hospitals and doctors are losing money on every deal. Is that correct?
Representative Hoffman. Not yet a representative, huh? Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, we have a reasonably good foundation for these high cost projections in the neighborhood of $1,000 a month when it comes right down to it.
Per individual.
We have experience with a very sick, very expensive GAMC program in which we had been looking at costs of about $1,000 a month in managed care. That's about a third of the forecasted population in this program. We also have experience with the Minnesota Care population, which is another large piece of the population coming into this program. We know what they are costing us in managed care rates, and we know that under federal rules that we're going to have to pay higher rates. A part of that's because of the change in benefits. Minnesota Care has a limited hospital coverage. When these people move into medical assistance, we have to give them unlimited hospital coverage. That's going to raise the cost 10 or 11%. We also have been holding down the capitation rates in Minnesota Care for this population, which is paid at 100% state cost, and we think in order to get CMS certification of the managed care rates, we're going to have to raise those rates an additional 8%. And so that, when you put it all together, that gets you at a cost per person per month approaching $1,000. There is something in this forecast which sort of touches on what you're asking about hospitals, which is we have in statute a law that says we have to rebase inpatient hospital rates every 2 years. And this sort of goes to the whole question of the interaction between the public programs and private cost. We did rebase inpatient hospital rates in 2007. And we did a four-year increase because we had put off the increase in 05. So we adjusted rates up 26% for the 4 years of inflation. We put off as a budget measure the rebasing of rates in 2009. We put off the rebasing in 2011. And we are now looking at a six-year update in 2013. And in this forecast, both for this population and the regular medical assistance population, we are figuring that the rebasing of inpatient hospital rates is going to be a 50% increase in 2013. So if that goes forward, that goes some ways to address the inpatient issue that you...
In other words, mentioned. Hospitals would be reimbursed at...
Representative Grunhagen.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm a freshman. I'm learning. I'm open to correction.
You're doing fine.
But, you know, I guess as my initial thought as a representative and with my background is, if the hospitals and doctors are losing money on this reimbursement rate, and yet you're charging at what appears to be on the surface four times what a private insurance company would charge to deliver the service, what is happening to all that money that it is not getting to the doctor and the hospital at a better level of reimbursement? And I think that's a question, I don't know, you know, we have to deal with, but you know, I don't expect you to answer it in 2 minutes, but five would be nice. But it goes back to my basic principle that I said when I think I introduced myself was government, you know, when I look at these figures, government is the most inefficient and expensive way to deliver any product or service. And we've got to figure out alternatives in the face of this budget crisis, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at... The one-page document summary of MA early expansion, looking at line 2, federal funds expected. I guess I'm not exactly sure where the document came from, if it was Mr. Hoffman or who. But anyway, I'm kind of chuckling at the word expected, and I say that from this perspective. I bought a car for my 16-year-old daughter, and the expectation was that she would pay for her insurance throughout the term of her having the car, and that expectation lasted about a week. So my question is, what if the federal funds that are expected don't come here? Who is obligated for the continuation of the program in lieu of the federal money not coming in?
Very good question, Representative Barrett. Who wants to answer that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Barrett. In order for the federal funds not to come here, the federal government, Congress, would have to do something to change the law that currently authorizes those dollars to come here. If that were to happen, I expect that we would be back here reviewing what options the state of Minnesota has, given that the federal government has backed out of its share of the funding for the program. And so it would come back to the legislature to make a decision on how we would handle it at that point.
Representative Barrett, I think it's fair to say that would create a new challenge for us at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I expected. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question, a follow-up to Representative Grunhagen's question. So when we're looking at the big document, Mr. Hoffman, and there's the monthly average payments, can you tell the committee, is that managed care, is that PMAP payments or fee-for-service payments or some hybrid of those, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's a mixture. It's what's assumed is a mixture like we have now with the children and parents, because what typically happens is people new to the medical assistance program spend 2 or 3 months in which they get fee-for-service coverage, And then they enroll in managed care, and from that time on, they're in managed care, and we pay a capitation payment. And because there's a lot of turnover in the program, what that looks like is, at a point in time, about a quarter of the enrollees are in fee-for-service status, and about three-quarters are in managed care. We've made a parallel assumption for the adults without kids, with the further assumption in this scenario that managed care would start in January of 12.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and just as a member of the committee, you have to keep in mind that if we eliminate all these programs for these people, people don't go away. They're still going to be in the state. They're still going to go to the emergency rooms, and they're still going to be treated by the hospitals, and the hospitals will get zero for that. And somebody's going to pay, and we all pay in our, what we put into our health care premiums because of that uncompensated care. The other, there was a question about why does it cost so much for this program. Virtually all the people that we're talking about in early enrollment in MA are people that are exceedingly ill. Almost all of them have so many chronic illnesses that they cannot work, period. And that's a very expensive group of people to provide health care to. It's not like the average person that's middle class working. They're a completely different group of people. And the last thing I would say about if the federal government or state government is the most efficient, perhaps we ought to remember that the VA program is one of the most efficient and perhaps the best healthcare system in America, run by the federal government.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Grinhagen.
One comment there. You know, I did not say the word eliminate in my comments. I don't know if, reform might have been there. But the other thing is, my precise question is, why isn't more of that money per person getting to the doctor and the hospital to reimburse for that care? I mean, and that's obviously something we'll have to look into. But, you know, it's costing that much. It's hard for me to understand that I sit in a meeting with hospital administrators saying we lose money on all four government programs. Well, when you're paying this much per person, regardless of the care, they shouldn't be losing money on the services that they're providing, or they should be getting reimbursed. So somewhere a lot of that money is being chewed up in, I'll skip the word I was going to use. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think
Mr.
it's
Johnson.
Important to understand that those dollars that are represented as those costs per person, first of all, are an estimate, as Mr. Hoffman said, based on our experience. But that those are the dollars that, in the fee-for-service side, are paid to the providers for the care that is provided for those individuals. And on the managed care side are capitated rates that are paid to the managed care corporations that are actuarially reviewed, actuarially approved rates that we pay. And you can look at the disclosure in terms of the dollars to the managed care organizations and how much of that money goes to admin and reserves, and it's quite low relative to other states. And I think it goes back to Representative Huntley's point that this is a very sick population, not a population you see in the private insurance market, and thus those costs seem unfamiliar. And wouldn't disagree with the rates that we pay being below the market and often below cost for certain provider groups. That has been an ongoing issue with the Minnesota Care Healthcare programs.
Well, Mr. Johnson, Representative Grinhagen, I would just comment that this committee and others in the past have reviewed a similar question, and that's the question about how the money is spent at the claims level. When we're talking about prepaid health services for the state of Minnesota, and we do not have good answers from the Department of Human Services so far. So although you're a freshman, I think it's a very good question. It's come up before, and we frankly don't have all the details yet.
But so I did something right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no question is a dumb question. So I'm glad you brought it up. But we will look into those things more, I think, as this committee goes on. And I think that's a theme we'll reflect here. This is a reform committee. Let's be willing to look at the possibility that we might need to do things differently. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think those kinds of discussions are definitely very valuable. I think the one question that I did hear asked, though, which I heard kind of, well, we'd have to come back and talk about it, but that is the question of what if the federal dollars do not come to cover the cost of this program? And then who's on the hook for those expenditures, presuming that we would take care of them? Will it then fall to the states to pick up any slack when the federal government does not come through? Last I heard, federal government wasn't exactly flush with money. So, you know, I think when you know that things are pretty tight there, matter of fact, a little bit worse than they even are here, I think it is a logical and reasonable question that if we don't know the answer now, we better find it out in regards to caring and taking care of these people than if the federal government, and that is that big if they do not.
Mr. Johnson.
Then what?
Ms. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I think we as a state would have to reassess in what form we could provide coverage to this population. I mean, obviously there'd be a large hole of roughly half a billion dollars a year in the cost of serving them under this version of the program, the medical assistance program that we have. It's unlikely, I think you're not incorrect, that the state would have that money, and that would mean we'd have to revisit if there's another way to go about serving this population. But I also have to say I've never experienced a situation where the federal government pulled out on a dime. It's always been there's warning, there's an ability for legislation together, there's some process that's put in place, some time is put in place for us to have the ability to make it a sound decision prior to the federal government backing out or ending the program.
Representative Kiffmeyer, follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would understand. I would say in the past that might have been the case. I don't think that we're in a time right now that some of those histories of the past, that the federal government will always just be there and come through with the additional dollars. I think that piggy bank has been shaken so much that I don't know that that's going forward into the future. That I would be quite as confident about that. But I do want to say, when you say revisit that, I think it also then, the question I would have is, will there be the authority for the state to change things, or will the state be bound by having opted into the early expansion? Will the state then have the ability and the authority to make some changes on the policy side or in the enrollment side, or is there going to be an MOE, maintenance of effort, that's going to tie our hands? Do you know the answer to that yet?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I think this is pretty speculative because this would require Congress to take some kind of an action without knowing what that action is. I can't speculate on what authority they would tie us to or not tie us to. I certainly would expect that states in many forms would be at Congress lobbying to not have their hands tied if, in fact, the federal government is going to back out of this.
Okay, I'll leave that for now, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Well, I just kind of perked up when I was thinking about the mechanics of the what if the money doesn't come. I have my concerns that it may not, but I hadn't thought of how we would handle that if it would. And in a, the federal government is continuing their budget resolutions kind of by the a week and then a couple of months, and I think it's good till February. And I mean, it is certainly a different world. So I just want to think, I'm going to ask you that later, just mechanically what would happen. I know it's hypothetical, but we pass a bill. We're going to pass a bill at some point, April or May off the floor. The governor will perhaps sign it, which would be nice. And so if we get a signed agreement and we're done, and then suddenly the federal money would dry up on something we've already counted on. That would be a novel circumstance. And so I think we just want to, just maybe just ruminate on that a little bit, and we'll talk about it later. Thank you.
Representative Barrett.
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't mean to belabor the point, but we are here to look at long-term solutions to the health and human services issues in Minnesota and provide solutions going forward. So we need to understand in pretty good detail what we could expect and not expect going forward. So I come back to the word expected, and so a more direct question would be, in 2014-2015, if the $3.313 billion in federal money shrinks to half, what would happen to this program? Where would the money come from to fund this program by law, by statute, as statute sits today with the signing by Governor Dayton earlier today. What would we be on the hook for?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, I'm not sure I can directly answer that. We'd have to look back at the law and see what it said. But again, I think that there would be an opportunity to reset state statute prior to having that happen, and to look at what other options we may have that would be affordable if the federal government was pulling out its share or some part of its share to fund care for this population or for a smaller part of this population if that were necessary. Again, I feel like we're dealing hypotheticals, and it's hard to answer exactly what that would be. We can look at the state law and see what exactly it would appear to tie us to, but generally speaking, we're accepting an option under the federal law, and if the federal government is going to change that option in some way, that would then have to come back before the federal government took this option away. We need to look now at what we can or can't do with the money that we have at the state level for the population and the need that we're looking at.
Well, Mr. Johnson, if I could point out, I think the question's been asked several times in different ways, but I think it's reasonable to assume if the federal government withdraws funds for a program which we're relying on in order to cover these people, the state would have to either find a way to fund that itself through some of its own resources or not provide those services. Would that be a fair assumption?
Mr. Chair, if we wanted to continue the exact same level of care for the same population, we would have to come up with state money to replace the federal share. We could also look at doing something different in terms of the level of care, different in terms of the population served, in order to make it fit within the state resources we have available. That would be the basic options we'd have.
Representative Barrett, a follow-up?
Quick follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. Concern, I guess, is that we are currently dealing with a $6.2 billion budget deficit, and again, we're looking for long-term solutions, both short-term and long-term, short-term to eliminate the deficit. So I'm worried about creating $1.6 or $3.3 billion deficits into the future, or potentially creating $3.3 billion deficits in the future, which will just send us down the same path in the same meeting in 4 to 5 years. So I don't know all the answers, but I really want to find out the answers, Mr. Chair, to these very important questions. Thank you.
Very good question. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're talking about the federal government and the deficit, it occurred to me that the tax cuts passed by the Congress in December are also contributing to the deficit. And that's a rhetorical point, and I think we're having a little bit of a rhetorical and political question here, but a really good policy discussion as well. Medicaid is a 45-year-old program, right? It's been paying, it's a state and federal partnership, been paying the states to provide care for disabled, seniors, families, and children since 1965, right? So if the question really is the federal government going to somehow pull out of Medicaid, I don't think that we can limit our concern to that just about the population 75% and below going into medical assistance for their health care coverage. I think we'll also have to think about the people who are in nursing homes, the people who are living in or in waivered services that are developmentally disabled, the people who are physically disabled and the care that they're getting. And what will we do then? If that were to happen, what would we do then to make sure that we are providing care for those populations that I think as we went around the table, we all said we want to make sure we're providing for? I think Medicaid is stable, has been. We're going to have different perspectives on that. I don't think we're taking a big gamble. But if somehow Medicaid was insolvent and we had a problem with that, our problem is much bigger than the population served below 75% of federal poverty. So we'll have a lot of work to do together, and it's going to be very difficult if that were the case. I hope not. I don't think so, but that's my perspective. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for that. And I kind of wanted to go in a similar direction. I kind of wanted to ask Mr. Johnson whether this discussion, which we're having, it's, you know, interesting rhetorical discussion, what if, whether it really bears on the decisions that we have to make in this committee, because it seems to me that the governor just signed today the executive order that the state is going to participate, and in the early expansion option, which we earned by our relatively good management of health care in this state. and that's kind of a done thing. And not really, unless I'm really missing something here, and please tell me if I am, Mr. Johnson, but that's not really, you know, except for the speculative way in the future, what if, it really doesn't impact on the budgetary decisions that we have to make, because that's kind of it's kind of off our plate, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Representative Liebling, we're kind of wandering a bit away from this in general. I don't know that that's a fair question to ask Mr. Johnson, since that's a decision the governor really made today. I'd like to try to draw us back to focusing on the overview and questions related to that, if I can. These are good conversations. We'll certainly have them around this table, but I think we're getting a little bit far afield. Mr. Johnson, do you want to continue?
Mr. Chair, I think we're ready to turn to Ms. Vogt's overview of the Healthcare Access Fund.
One question. Representative Abler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I recognize your moderating influence on this discussion, but I think it's one we're going to have, and I respect Representative Liebling and Representative Murphy a lot. But I think the part that gives me the concern and why I have not been a fan of this thing, and I don't have a repeal bill in the hopper we're going to put in, but I just do want to point out to members that if you look at this piece of paper that is right in front of us here, that the federal funds expected, it's $4.5 billion over 4.5 years, and that's a lot of money. And if you extrapolate that to the national level. Maybe MMB can comment, but we're about 2% of the country in most of our population sizes and all. So if you multiply times 50, that's some 200 some billion dollars that the feds have to put forward to do this piece, just as a round number, and there's probably a better number than that. And so that's in 14 and 15, you know, and the trillion eight or so we're short is through 2011. And so that's... I think the discussion we're having, and I think we can't solve it today, but it's really good to bring it up. And I think we absolutely have to keep in mind as we do our budgeting as a chair, I have to bear in mind that, wow, that may not be so readily available. And if only a billion of that $4.5 billion doesn't come, the bottom lines go from a slight gain to a loss of $800 million. And that's just considerable. So we'll have the discussion, and I didn't mean to pour gas on your fire again, Mr. Chair. But
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much, and to Chair Abler. We haven't had a lot of chance to talk about this over the course of the summer and the fall, but I think, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, when we are talking about people who are old, either physically or developmentally disabled, or with multiple chronic conditions, there are costs associated with their care, whether it's in a public program or if they're uninsured. And if we remember that there are costs associated, and we don't get caught up on where they're covered, but instead how we figure out how to deliver care better and pay for it differently, I think we can find a path to reducing the costs. But I don't think just saying, well, we can't afford those people anymore, so we're just going to cut them off, is a real solution. It's just passing the buck on to, I think, middle-class families, and that I don't think we can afford.
Representative Weibler.
Well, Representative Murphy, you've just summarized my first 8 minutes of the conversation, that we absolutely want to look after the people, and we better find more effective, targeted ways to do all that. And so, see? Here we are, working together, getting things done.
And, Mr. Chair, that's the work we've been doing together for the last 4 years at least. So I look forward to more.
Very good. Let's continue. Why don't you introduce yourself to the committee? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with the Minnesota Management and Budget Department. I track the Healthcare Access Fund, which our agency puts out each November, February, and at the end of session to incorporate any legislative action that happened during the session. And I was asked to be here today to do an overview of the fund.
Thanks for being here.
I think everyone has this in their packet. It's the one page that talks about the Healthcare Access Fund. There's a lot of numbers on it, so I'll try to boil it down. Quickly. it helps, I think, to break it down into, well, first let me start by saying the fund basically exists largely to fund our Minnesota Care healthcare program. It's important to look at the sources in the fund, the uses of the fund, and then there's a piece about transfers that I'm going to talk a little bit about. Does everyone have their sheets?
I'm not sure people are.
Yeah. This guy, don't have it?
It's kind of in a spreadsheet format, members.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You have the paper?
Staple.
Is it in your folder when you got here?
No.
Ms. Vogt, when you talk, if you could pull the microphone a little closer to your mouth, too, just so people can hear you. Thank you. We'll take just a moment here to make sure all the members have the document we're referring to. It says Healthcare Access Fund at the top.
Okay, I'll share here.
Members, who doesn't have it yet? Mr. Barrett, Representative Barrett, Representative Huntley. Do we have additional copies? They're being made. Ms. Vogt, why don't we go ahead and get started, and then we'll get copies for the members who don't have them.
Okay. Maybe I'll back up just a little bit. Basically, this fund exists to fund our Minnesota Care program. That's largely what the spending is that goes into the program. I think it's helpful to look at the fund balance in chunks to kind of understand the ins and outs of what's happening. The sources or inputs to the fund are taxes. There's a 2% tax on gross revenues for hospitals, surgical centers, healthcare providers, and wholesale drug distributors. That's a big portion of the revenues to the fund. There's also a 1% tax on gross premiums to HMOs, nonprofit health plan corporations, and community integrated service networks. And there's a little bit of funding in there that is federal matching dollars on administrative spending. So if you look at the total resources available line, that's pretty much what's in there. Then the next section down is all spending for the program, which is largely, like I said, spending for the Minnesota Care program, which is a forecasted program. Which means we fund whoever is eligible for the program under current law. We also have an appropriation here for the Department of Human Services, which is a big portion of which is to do intake for Minnesota Care operations. That's also done at the county, but this is the DHS portion. There's also the county, but this is the DHS portion. There's also an appropriation in here that goes to health, and a couple smaller ones for the legislature and the Department of Revenue for the work that they do related to the fund. The next section down has to do with a number of transfers that happen between this fund and mostly the general fund. Just wanted to give you a little sense for what generally always comes out of this fund and helps fund the general fund. One of those things is a $48 million transfer that happens per year that's in current law and happens as long as there's enough money in this fund to transfer to the general fund. There's also a couple of larger transfers in fiscal 10 and 11 that you'll see, some of which was used to pay for the new GAMC program in the general fund. And there's also a loan in that section of $40 million that will be paid back in 12 that was actually part of the budget solution in the general fund last session. Then you'll see a line associated with the early expansion of Medicaid that's based upon the January 1st, 2011 date. And I can get a little bit more into detail on that in a second. And then your bottom line of the fund, you'll see that there's a balance in the fund through fiscal 12. And then we will start to see a deficit in the fund in fiscal 13 and fiscal 14. and then a surplus again in 15, and that is basically a result of the fact that the federal government will start paying 100% for the Medicaid group after that point, and at that point we will have the groups left in Minnesota care that are not adults without children. So that's why that looks a little funny on the bottom line. I think, are there any questions up to this point before I move on to MA expansion? I might just explain that piece a little bit.
Any questions from members? I know, again, this could easily raise the question we had with the last group of, or the last discussion about, obviously your projections here assume the money's going to be there mm-hmm. from the federal government beyond 2014. So, mm-hmm. any other questions? I don't see any, so if you want to proceed.
Okay, so let me go back to this line, because we are reserving in the general fund, as you know, an amount of funding that will fund the Adults Without Kids group for the early expansion. Part of why we want to show this healthcare access fund balance is to show this group of people is currently funded in Minnesota care. We have savings in Minnesota care because that group of people shifts from one fund to the other fund. And so that's why you see a net savings on that line that helps the balance in this fund. If you look on the back page of your fund balance, it gives you a little more information about what exactly is in that net savings number. You'll see a big number that's savings to Minnesota Care for the group shifting. $137 million in 11, $396 in 12. That savings is a little bit offset by some transfers that are also in current law, transfers that go to the general fund in order to fund the early expansion on that side of the balance sheet. So that's kind of the bottom line of that fund. I think just wanted to show that portion of it in a little more detail, because as you look at these populations, they're funded in both funds, and it's hard to look at the shifting and what it costs in each fund unless you talk about both of these funds together. They're intimately tied.
Representative Liebling, you have a question?
Thank you. I'm wondering if you can remind us of why money is going out of the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund.
You're talking about their transfers that are in current law, so they're in
right,
law from last session.
Mm-hmm. Just going straight from the just straight into the general fund, and
going
what that's
straight
for.
Into the general fund. Yep. But the purpose was to reflect the funding going with the people that are the Adults Without Kids that were funded in Minnesota Care and are going to be funded in the general fund in Medicaid going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Okay, maybe I misunderstood. I thought there was just money that was going, but not connected with the expansion of medical assistance, mm-hmm. but okay. just transfers. Just yep. I thought I heard you refer to the some other money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there are some additional transfers on the front page. I can go through that list if that would be helpful.
Yes.
The $48 million per year is in current law that we do that every year as long as there are resources in the fund. Mm-hmm. The other larger one down below that says one-time transfers or loans, a portion of those transfers was done to the general fund to fund the General Assistance Medical Care Program, the new capped program. And then a portion of that is a loan to the general fund, which will be paid back in fiscal 12. And that's all in current session law.
If you want to proceed, Ms. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, that and members, that's all I had on the fund balance, unless members have other questions.
Representative Abler.
I have a couple questions. If you can just maybe, I remember the $48 million, but can you just remind us why we do that? It made sense as I remembered it, but I just...
Why the 48?
Yeah, why million? Did... That's based on something.
Ms. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Hoffman, that goes back many years, and it's not at the tip of my tongue, but I will get the answer to you today. I have the statute at my desk.
Thank you. Yeah. I have another just to point out,
Representative Abler,
I had the privilege of meeting with you and some others to get tuned up on this, and there's some more content to this that I think would be productive for the members. If there's two lines to compare, the total resources available, which is the top box, and then there's the total expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And if you notice, by 2013, that the resources are about two-thirds of a billion, and the expenditures are something over a billion. The expansion benefits the fund by $200 million, leaving a deficit. If you look, it's not really $150 million. It's actually worse than that because there was a surplus. The bottom line is not an annual amount loss. You have to add the $43 million to the $150 million. So in 2013, counting even the bonus $200 million that we've talked about earlier now, leave that alone for now. But assuming it comes, we're still short $190 million by people we've chosen to serve in that part. And that's part of the duty of this committee, well, the old one, the last committee that met, the finance version, to find a way to rescue that. And there's a number of methods that will be at our disposal, which maybe I'll ask you to talk about. But that's one of the little bonuses I didn't know. There's $43 million in the bank account to draw down to make it only $150 million. But if you notice in the next year, there's bonuses from the expansion. But if you look at the revenues and the costs, they're still considerable. And we've made some decisions on a legislative basis, I'll leave it at that, in the final bills to serve groups of people. And they've expanded a pretty generally consistency, either a lot or a little, over the years to get us to the point that we're at that big deficit. And that will be part of our duty. Perhaps some... Ms. Vogt, you can tell us what choices we have. Is that a question for you or Mr. Hoffman to talk about what choices we have about how to manage a $190 million deficit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the
Ms. Vogt.
$190 million, I'm not quite following you on where that, the $150?
Well, yeah, if the deficit in 2013 is going to amount to the sum of 43 and 150, and so... It's nice having a bank account so to guard against contingencies, but in the biennium we have to manage $150 million. So I'll just ask that question. So what tools are at our disposal?
Okay.
And what's current law about what to do about that if we don't do anything to help the community?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I just wanted to point out one thing, that the Health Care Access Fund balance per fiscal year is actually what it is. So you wouldn't add up the two fiscal years together. So it would be what the balance is as a point in time at the end of 14 or the end of 15. Okay. The second part of your question, I believe under current law, there is a statute that allows the Commissioner of Human Services to manage the Minnesota Care Program and the population if there's a foreseeable deficit. We hope that the problem in the fund is resolved before that would have to happen.
Ms. Vogt, could you be more specific about what just tell us what the management is? I know we would disenroll single adults without children first,
mm-hmm.
the ones that are left in Minnesota Care. There'd be very few of those because they're all in the medical assistance program now. Is that right? Is that right?
One second. Order after.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler,
Mr. Hoffman.
The expansion of 75% leaves about half of the adults without children in the program. They're split just about half over and under 75 of FPG. So it would, if the question is, are there enough of them left to solve the problem by eliminating eligibility for them, the answer is yes.
And just one more thing. I'm just helping members understand. The purpose of this joint hearing is to help you understand where we are. And I didn't know this part till I was the chair designee. It's like, oh no. So it was kind of not a good surprise for me. It's helpful to know that, and not very nice to know. But and so in the governor's budget, he would be bringing forward a solution to this. That would be part of his duty. Is that right? Ms. Vogt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe that's been the approach in the past. Given where I'm sitting, I can't speak for the governor, but I would expect it to be addressed. In some
Thank
way.
You. Representative Huntley.
Just to point out, members, that if we start to disenroll people, and particularly if you're talking about adults without kids, what you're going to do is kick off working people to cover the lower income people that can't work. And the whole idea of Minnesota Care was to provide health care for people that are working.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the subject of trying to understand the numbers a little bit better so I can be a better informed legislator, the question I have is, Ms. Vogt, regarding the projections, we could probably go into an hour-long conversation of where the projections came from, how accurate they are, and so so on and so forth. How accurate are they?
Cause we don't have an hour, but Ms. Vogt.
Well, we work very closely with the Department of Human Services forecast research, and I'm not sure if there's been a meta-analysis of that, but let me have George.
Yeah. Maybe that was a question for Mr. Hoffman.
Yes, Mr.
Hoffman.
We do better in the general fund than we do on the Minnesota Care Program. In the general fund programs as a whole, if you look at what we spend in the next year after the legislation, after the legislative session, in the next fiscal year, our 10-year forecast accuracy in the general fund is about 97% for that next year. For the Minnesota Care Program, it's about 90%. It's about 90% for the Minnesota Care Program. So it's a more volatile program, as we are seeing in the past 6 months with the enrollment shooting up in that program.
It's a good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I follow?
Representative Barrett, follow up.
Just one quick follow. When you say 90%, sir, are you referring to the expenses or the revenue coming in? Which would you consider to be more likely to fall or rise, Mr.
It's
Chair?
Our expenditure forecast. We provide the expenditure forecast for the Minnesota Care Program, so it's our expenditure forecast for the year compared to actual expenditures for the year. It doesn't take the revenue part of it into consideration at all. We don't do that part.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just to the members, I have no idea what Mr. Hoffman's personal politics are, but I can tell you his predictions are usually accurate, or they're even more conservative, and I will tell you that he does a good job, and he takes a very conservative approach to his estimates.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Vogt, do you have more, or are we transitioning now to the next part of the report? Are there other questions from members, first of all? Okay, seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Johnson, do you have more, or? Who's next? Ah, there we go, Ms. Rankin. Can you state your name for the record?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services, and I am responsible for a complete change in topic to take you back to the last few pages in the original packet that Mr. Johnson walked you through. If you could find that packet and turn to page 8. This is information that's, I think, primarily useful to you members who are on the Finance Committee, because this is information that I'm working off of page 8. That's the packet, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm working off of page 8. It's titled Provisions in Statute or Law Shifting DHS Payments from One Fiscal Year to Another. And as you might suspect from the title, this is primarily, I think, of interest to members of the Finance Committee. But what this does is capture in one place, there are three provisions, three kinds of provisions in state law that have already been used, been put in place for budgetary purposes, and the effect of these provisions is that it is shifting payments for an obligation that has been incurred in one fiscal year into the next fiscal year. The first item on the sheet is referred to as the managed care or capitation June payment delay. And briefly, all this, it boils down to for managed care organizations that are providing care to our MA and Minnesota Care enrollees. In state law, it says that they do not get paid for their monthly services provided in the month of June until July 1, or until the July of that same calendar year. The sole reason for this is a fiscal shift, a budgetary savings. The dollar amounts in the table are courtesy of Mr. Hoffman and his reports and forecast staff. This is an example of one of the uses that the detail in the forecast document gets put to. You can see that the two bolded numbers are the forecasted amounts of what the state share dollar is of that savings. So the $100 million is the value to the state. That's $100 million that does not get paid in fiscal year 11, but it must get paid in fiscal year 12. There is a second table under this item, which is talking about the Minnesota Care piece. So this is healthcare access fund dollars. So just so you have in front of you a sense of the scope of that commitment. Down at the bottom of the page, there's another item. It's known as the withhold payments, the managed care withhold payments. And this is a provision that's been in statute for quite a number of years. It has recently changed to a higher percentage. But essentially what it's doing is for managed care organizations that are serving our Minnesota Care and MA populations, the DHS, we withhold a certain percentage of their calculated monthly capitation payment. And we withhold it for 12 months, and then we actually don't pay it until the following July. So a bit of context, you might recall when Mr. Hoffman was talking about the forecast. Our capitation contracts, they run on a calendar year. And so, in essence, what we're doing is we are withholding what is now 9.5% of the payments to managed care organizations. We withhold it for the duration of the calendar year, and then we pay it all back to them in a lump sum the following July. So you can see at the top of page 9 the dollar amounts on the general fund, that this particular standing statute means that the state is committed to pay managed care plans a forecasted amount of $104 million, for example, that will be paid this coming July, and that's actually for capitation services to enrollees from calendar year 10. Comparable numbers in the next section of page 9, so you get a sense of the magnitude of the Minnesota Care piece of that.
Ms. Gold, Representative Abler.
Yeah, Ms. Rankin, thanks. Now, is this some? These were increased in late recent times, and so I have two questions, and I'll just ask them both. And then, is this some? I remember because I was on the conference committee. Are these perpetual, or is this these one-time shifts that are? So are these already? That's my question.
Mr. Chair and members, to answer your questions in reverse, they are in permanent law. These are not one-time shifts. And then your second question, I think that's actually, you're right, it has recently changed, and that's probably why Mr. Hoffman provided me numbers starting with calendar year 8, where you can see it was 5%. It had been 5% for quite a while, and it was in the context of setting budgets in the past two legislative sessions that the percentage has been increased, and so now we're sitting at 9.5% for MA.
Mr.
And
Chairman, Representative Abler,
Mr. Hoffman,
it was changed in the 09 session, and the session law phased it up from 8 to 9.5, and then the governor, by an allotment, moved it up to 9.5. Effective the next January. And so we're, because the unallotment was for the current biennium, it's still in permanent law after the current biennium because of the session law changes, which were going to raise it to 9.5 anyway.
Oh,
and then the rate is different in the Minnesota Care program. The amount held out is different, and that's also a matter of what was put in the law.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
So just Representative Abler.
So just to clarify, so in the 2019 forecast, these are already factored in because they're permanent. Is that right? I mean,
if we had a 2019 right. forecast, we would assume it because it's the current law.
Thank you very much.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Rankin, I'm wondering whether or not that's labeled the managed care withhold payments are the same as what has been known as the performance withholds, which were really tied to quality performance, not just a cash flow shift, or are those two separate things?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they're actually split. They are basically the same thing. At least I think the first 5% was the same thing and is the performance payment, mm-hmm. and the subsequent increase to 9.5. The extra points held out are not tied to performance. Almost always, all of the money is paid back in our experience.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, as someone who's concerned that we always have to have a continually improving system, meeting benchmarks, this has always been an area of concern to me because I think when we have performance withholds, it should be with benchmarks that encourage improvement and not the bar set so low that everyone gets it. And I think sometimes we've kind of mixed up cash flow withholds with performance, and I think we really ought to look at, as a policy committee at least, the issue of how do we do, what's the best approach to quality improvement, and should we be doing the kind of mixing up of things that we've done in the past. I think that's an issue that we should spend some time on.
Thank you. Do you want to proceed, Ms. Rankin?
What?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Abler.
Just one more question. So we have this permanent shift to the plans that's built in, which costs somebody some money to borrow on an ongoing basis, plans at this point. Is the money that they spend to borrow the money based on the time value of money or whatever that built in, would that be a rate increaser as they get their actuarially sound rates? How is this accounted for with all that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hoffman.
Representative Abler, I don't think it counts in their costs that the actuaries look at, but it would be a question for Karen P.
Yeah, so you can just pass that on to her and tell her I was curious. Thank you.
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and members, then item 3 at the bottom of page 9, this is a one-time shift. Unlike the two managed care delays, this one is only a rider, and it will expire. it will, by the language in the rider, it expires after the shift that the payment is made in July of 13. But those are the values. This is fee-for-service payments that the state makes for inpatient hospital service and non-hospital acute care payments. In both cases, there's a rider that says we don't pay them in June, we don't pay them until July, and you can see the values there.
Mr. Chairman, you might note that we save 45 and we spend 50 in we save 45 in June 11 and we spend 50 million in June in July. This is because the enhanced federal matching comes to an end, and we can get a 55% federal match in June, but only a 50% federal match in July. That was not the situation when this was put in law, but it's the situation now.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Hoffman, so if we want to repeal that transfer, we could make $5 million, is that what that, of the sky, money falling from the sky, is that correct?
Yes, you
Mr.
can
Hoffman.
Get $5 million, but you have to put up the cash in fiscal 11, and then
right,
and then you save $5 million more in fiscal 12.
Okay, and I have one
Representative
more question.
Representative Abler.
Is the $34 million a subset of the $45
million? That's a shift 2 years later, also
right.
At the end of the biennium.
But so it's... Mr. Chair, so if it, but we pay back the 45 or the 50, and we take another 34, so we, okay.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the bottom section is essentially saying that move the clock forward 2 years in June of 13, we're using the same maneuver that we're using at the end of the coming fiscal year, where we are not going to pay for inpatient hospital and non-hospital acute care fee for service in June. We're going to wait and pay it in July.
Right.
And that was
a
tail savings.
Mr. Hoffman.
The values are different because the current law says that what we delay in June of 11 is essentially all of the relevant payments, but for the delay in 13, there are specified amounts to delay in the current law.
Okay, and so I'm just trying to
enable it.
This was just one of those little surprises that I was getting. So there's a $50 million little bonus target for us just to stay open, and then to honor the next budget committee, then they have to do $34 million. So we just keep sharing the gifts. Thank you, I appreciate that.
Ms. Rankin.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, if you turn to page 10, this is a summary of an issue that was dealt with by the legislature last session. And what this does is simply takes, as members who were here at the time are aware and new members have probably heard about, the governor had made a decision to address budget imbalance through unallotment. And in the human services area in particular, that took the form of dollar unallotments in various places in the human services budget. And they're all listed here. There's 30. Altogether, 30 separate line items that were all part of when people talk about the governor's unallotments, you see them here. In the course of closing the legislative session last year, the bill that was passed in the first special session included actions that affected some of those items that had originally been on the governor's unallotment list. And so what you see here on this page is the individual items sorted out by categories. So the first section, lines 1 through 4, these were items where they were all one-time appropriations. So by their own nature, they were only available to be a one-time budget reduction. And these were unallotment items that the legislature then enacted in last session's special session budget balancing bill. Next section, lines 5 through 8, you see there were another grouping of items where these were one-time payment shifts where by virtue of shifting the payment, the you can take a reduction in the current biennium and you don't have to repay it until the 12-13 biennium. These values are actually in the MA program, and because of the way our MA statute is set up under current law, they are incorporated now in the reports and forecasts forecast for MA. So the repayment is occurring automatically through the forecast. There was another section of these items where the legislative decision was to make the reductions that were on the unallotment list, but only make them one-time reductions and not extend them permanently into fiscal 12 and 13. So for example, line nine, eliminating, there were two small CD grants. Those grants, because of the way we budget in the Department of Human Services base budget for fiscal 12 and 13, that $393,000 is essentially back in our budget because the reduction was only made one time for the 10-11 biennium. So that's that center section. There was one item of reduction that has been made permanent in the program area at DHS called State Operated Services, which is the direct care services in what used to be called the regional treatment centers. There is a $5 million reduction that was made there, and that has been enacted permanently. So when you look at the State Operated Services budget, it is $5 million lower for 12 and 13 than it otherwise would have been. The last sections on this page, there were cases where the legislative decision last spring was to do something different than what the governor had done in his unallotment order. And so you see them all listed here. For example, line 23, child support enforcement grants. What the legislature decided to enact was essentially the same reduction in fiscal year 10, but a lesser reduction in fiscal year 11. So with that orientation to the page, that's the information that you have collected on one sheet as kind of a summary of the status quo now.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Rankin. Any questions from members?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah. Ms. Rankin. These unallotments, the majority of them expire July 1, 2011. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Right. Chair, Representative, that's correct. That's another way to interpret the phrase when we talk about a one-time reduction. It ends at the end of the current fiscal, the current biennium.
In which case the spending blinks back on.
Correct.
Representative Grunhagen.
And so, you know, and I'm just throwing out, technically, or in theory, you could extend these unallotments, which the money already hasn't been used, and you would save this additional money by extending the allotments either a year, 2 years, or permanently. Would that be correct?
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that would be a choice that legislators can make.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the total unallotment was between $2.5 and $3 billion.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is correct, although the total on this sheet gets nowhere near that large amount.
Mr. Chairman, I know it affected other areas, but I was just getting a overall, if we extended those unallotments in all categories, we would reduce our deficit significantly by almost half or close to half, just by extending money that already wasn't being used, and it seems like the system has been meeting the needs of the people who need it. Anyway, I just threw that out for people to think about.
That's partially true, Representative Grunhagen, although I believe education dollars were in there as well. So, but your point in a global sense, I think, is well taken. Ms. Rankin, does that conclude?
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, that's it for page 10, and then I have one last topic and one last page, page 11. And the information on here is responding to a request from Representative Abler, and this is shifting topics to the stimulus and the impact of the stimulus at the Department of Human Services. I think one of the reasons that Representative Abler asked for the information that I'm going to go over is it harkens back to the very first page that you looked at when Mr. Johnson was testifying earlier this afternoon. He pointed out the difference in the state appropriation, the number for fiscal 10 and 11 biennium being significantly lower, and because of the impact of stimulus money. So what this sheet does is it portrays our Department of Human Services direct appropriated budget. The column A is the base budget that you saw earlier this afternoon, and that portrays our actual spending in fiscal 10 and our budgeted spending in fiscal 11. But these numbers in column A many of them have in them an impact of federal stimulus. So that if you look at the total dollar amount, and I don't know if you have this sheet in some color printing or if it's all black and white. It was supposed to be color for everyone.
Members, do you have it in color?
I do.
You do?
Okay.
Black and white? Okay. Some have it in color, some do not, Ms. Rankin, so you may want to do some cross-referencing.
Chairman?
Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think the color was what was distributed today. You may have two copies of this, which I have. Mm-hmm. And if you look at both copies you might have, one could be colored.
I believe you're correct, Representative Lanning. I think the information is the same, though. I don't think there was any change. It's just that some copies were distributed today and some were not.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I won't bore you with horror stories of our
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This might be a good time to remind the audience, all of whom have messages I think they'd like to deliver at one point or another, that the Minnesota House does not have color printers. We are frugal internally.
We are a frugal place, yes, Representative Abler. Ms. Rankin.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, then what I wanted to point out is at the bottom of column A, there's a first line that says total, and that's it says 9,862,000,000. That's comparable to the numbers that were on the earlier charts that Mr. Johnson took you through. And the thing you need to be careful of is if you were to look at that number and then compare it to, if you look under column E, the total of 13,664,000,000, if you could say, wait a minute, what's going on at DHS if their 10-11 budget is 9.86 billion, but their 12-13 budget is 13.66 billion. I mean, that agency is really doing some incredible things to have a growth like that. And a lot of the problem, or a lot of the story that gets lost, is that there this thing called the federal stimulus added a lot of one-time federal dollars into programs that we operate at the Department of Human Services, and most of that federal stimulus money enabled the state legislators to say, okay, we're going to use more federal money for the current 10-11 biennium, and that will let us pull back and not spend as much state general fund money at DHS. We'll have general fund money then that we can use in other parts of the state budget.
So, Ms. Rankin, on an apples-to-apples basis, biennium to biennium, we're talking, that's where you get the 19.3% increase from biennium to biennium.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the point of this chart. The point of this chart is to adjust our 10-11 base budget that's portrayed in column A by doing, we had actually two different kinds of impacts from stimulus money at DHS. There were cases where parts of the federal stimulus bill added additional money into federal block grants, for example, that DHS receives and passes out in grants to counties and to other entities. And it was a straight increase. And so the legislature just essentially let that money flow through, and communities and individuals in Minnesota have benefited from, for 2 years, they've had a bit more federal money, a bit more resources to do things in existing programs. That's all what's listed in column B. Though that is, and it's a relatively small amount of money. It's $106 million, and it was sprinkled in primarily in some block grants in the TANF area, also in the Children and Economic Support grants. So there was a big increase in a homelessness housing block grant, and there was a big increase in the Community Services Block Grant, which funds CAP agencies around the state. Those are the two largest items that had the increase. Then column C is the rest or the other kind of stimulus impact at the agency.
Representative Barrett, did you want to ask a question at this point?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Ms. Rankin, I'd like to get back to the thought about the federal stimulus dollars and how they affected both the current year spending and future year spending. I'm looking at the medical assistance line item of 5.883 in 2010-2011, of which you add on to that $1.5 billion of federal stimulus dollars to get a total fund of $7.3 billion, correct?
Yes. That's correct.
That's right.
So, Mr. Chair, and then in the 2012-13, that number goes up to $8.7 billion. I think what you said, and correct me if I'm wrong or confirm that I'm correct, are you saying we are receiving one-time stimulus money for a program that is a long-term program, of which in the future we will not have that federal stimulus money to pay for that $8.7 billion expense?
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, I'm saying that we did. That is what is happening in the current biennium. The stimulus money that is in the medical assistance program ends on June 30th of this year. So that it ends at the end of the 10-11 biennium. So when you look at the number in column E, which is the 12 and 13, this is Mr. Hoffman's forecasted number of what the state funding will need to be for medical assistance in the 12 and 13 biennium. And that has no stimulus money in it at all.
So in order to continue the commitment, you have to add that much to the expenditure. Ms. Rankin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the way that the medical assistance statute is set up, it's kind of an automatic that it's an entitlement program, and from a budgeting standpoint, what that means is the money is there, is automatically going to be there to pay for the services of the eligible people. The eligible services, eligible people, at the rates that you all specify in statute.
that make sense, Representative Barrett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. it does. Thank yes. you very much. I don't mean to.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand. Does it make sense? Is a it's a different kind of question. Of yes. At any rate, the question that I have here on that same subject, though, is there anything in current statute or federal law that mandates that ongoing expenditure that about an additional $1.4 billion? You know, sometimes when you get stimulus money, we've had strings, maintenance of effort, you can't go back, you know, you're pegged to a certain date. Is there anything like that in this regards to the additional $1.4 billion when the federal stimulus money is not there to cover it?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I would turn your question and look at it in a little bit different way. What makes it so that we have now forecasted expenditures of $8.7 billion from the state as what we will need to pay medical assistance in 12 and 13 is because of the provisions in state law that determined who is eligible for MA, what kind of services our MA program includes, and what kind of rates we pay for them. Now, when the stimulus bill was passed, it did include some maintenance of eligibility requirements where we were not allowed to change the income eligibility of people for the medical assistance program. As, for example, whatever was the eligibility, there's a phrase that I'm losing. There's a particular standards
and procedures.
Yes, standards and procedures, and there's a third term too. But in essence, what that meant was that we could not change the state statute in such a way that it would change someone's income eligibility for the MA program. Yeah. And that was from, I want to say, June of 08. And it was supposed to last through the stimulus period. Now, we actually have, in the intervening time, the federal health care reform law passed, and that has a different but related, connected maintenance of eligibility in it. So in future hearings, when you're talking about the MA program and what you can and cannot do, you're still going to be hearing about MOE and maintenance of eligibility. It won't be anymore because of the stimulus, because the stimulus requirement ends with the end of this current biennium. But it is in federal law, and it is a consideration for you when you're looking at the 12 and 13 budget decisions that you're making, because there is eligibility restriction. That is not my phone.
I don't have one.
Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, and just to that point, in the handouts that people got, not from the returning veterans, but from the freshman packet that we created, there was a document from DHS. In there, you'll see a 3-page or 4-page description. We're going to go over it in our committee at some point. But it's like 16 notes of detail about what you have to do, which is far beyond today. But that's going to be discussed. That's on the list to talk about. So it's a really important topic.
Representative Grunhagen.
I was just sketching myself, to tell you the truth.
Okay. Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify, it's not a maintenance of effort in the sense that we have to spend a certain amount of money. It's maintenance of effort rules that there are certain restrictions on what we can change in the program. And change in eligibility is one of those things. So it doesn't tie us to a specific amount of money, but it may make it harder to make changes in order to spend less money.
That makes sense.
Representative Gernhagen.
I will make this comment just as a point of observation is, you know, I think it shows the fallacy, economic fallacy, of using one-time money to pay ongoing expenses. All you do is kick the can down the road and make the problem worse than what it originally was. And the reason I say that, I was a school board member for about 16 years, and we did the same thing on the school board. We took one-time money and tried to pay ongoing expenses, and all we did, we wound up in statutory operating debt. Finally, we got in administration who said, we're going to correct this problem. We corrected it, and we went from a major SOD to a multi-million dollar surplus, over a $4.5 million surplus in a relatively small district in about a 3 to 4 year period of time without a major tax increase. And we did it because we changed the structure of how we delivered the education and still maintained a strong academic and athletic program. So, you know, all I'm trying to say is let's all be mindful that to try to use something like one-time money to pay ongoing expenses only makes the problem worse down the road. And it goes back to Representative Abler's opening comments. We need to structurally change how we meet the needs of the people. We're not denying the needs, but we've got to look at how we're meeting those needs. Thank you.
Point well taken. Very good. Other questions? Ms. Rankin?
Okay, so Mr. Chair and members, I guess I would just summarize this conversation about what's on page 11 here in front of you in the two percentage numbers in the bottom right-hand side of the page under column E. The first one, 34.9%, that's a calculation of the change in the DHS budget if you ignore the stimulus money. And then if you take account of the stimulus money and adjust it we've adjusted it in two ways here, where we've excluded stimulus money that was going to be used for brand new activities or additional activities, and then we excluded that because our lens was, well, the legislature wouldn't have appropriated money for those activities, so there wouldn't be those increases. We excluded those. Then we looked at the other column of stimulus and said in situations where stimulus was used one time as a one-time relief mechanism, that the legislature would have determined that they were going to make those same spending choices. We added that stimulus money back in. That gets to an adjusted bottom line and an adjusted percentage change of the 19.3 that you see down at the bottom of the page.
Representative Abler.
This is a very helpful piece. Thanks for putting it together. I'm trying to get, as we talked earlier, to get our own, everybody can agree that what number we're starting from. And so maybe it's $11 billion for, but there's a Minnesota Care piece in here, that which is also on here, so it's not just general fund. Is there an interaction on this? This is done as of today. So this, all the interactions with the expansion piece are figured into this. Is that right? In terms
yes.
of the expenditure?
Ms. Rankin.
Yes, and Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, this is not just general fund. You are correct.
Right.
This is, however, direct appropriations. So funds that you have control over as legislators, and if you don't appropriate the money to DHS, we won't have it to operate. So it's healthcare access fund, it's general fund, it's TANF, it's that little bit of state government special revenue fund and lottery, which is back on page one of the packet. It doesn't deal with the statutory appropriations or the sort of automatic federal share, for example, that comes down through our MA program that the provider sees when the provider gets paid to serve an MA client.
Oh.
That's not in here.
Okay. So I appreciate this is very
Representative Abler.
So.
Okay.
And I just have one more housekeeping. I don't know how much you have left to do, but
Representative.
I think we're almost done with the math here, but this has been, I think, a very good hearing. I think you've just done the immersion version of the Finance Committee, as Mr. Hoffman said. as you look at this a second time, it'll make more sense. The third time, it'll make more sense. I'm told you should leave your little, these folders are for leaving behind here to the freshmen. If there's something you want to keep just to have around as a save folder, anything left like here will be thrown away. So, is that right? Good job.
Very good point. And we'll have committee rules that we can talk about, members, in about a week. Just to give you a little bit of idea for the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, a little path ahead, we will meet on Tuesday. We will meet on Tuesday. We will not meet Wednesday because of the Humphrey Institute program, and again, you're encouraged to participate in that. And then we'll continue with the regularly scheduled meetings the following week. Who? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman Weiss. As an old legislator, but a new member of this committee, I want to commend you for the way this was organized today. This was very good. And the presenters, we hear a lot of people that come before committees, but this data was excellent and very well presented, taking very complex material and making it understandable to those of us who are not experts in this. So I commend all of you for a very good job.
Point well taken, Representative Lanning, and really thanks to Representative Abler for organizing this. This is tough stuff. And regardless of what perspective we have on it, these are facts that are going to be really important to our conversation. So if you want to keep them in your safe folder, that's fine. I for my part, I think I'm probably going to put them in a three-ring binder that I can reference regularly myself. So whatever you want to do, I would suggest hanging on to these documents from today, because this is really, really good background information and very important to the discussions we're going to have. I also want to thank our testifiers for the time you spent this afternoon and your expertise. Mr. Hoffman and I were joking a little bit outside the hall between our various committee meetings that we ought to have a stump Mr. Hoffman session one of these times. I don't think we'd succeed. His institutional knowledge and knowledge of the details is extremely valuable, so thank you very much. And to Ms. Voigt and Mr. Johnson and Ms. Rankin, thank you very much. Oh, yes. Yeah, we can't forget to adjourn. This meeting is adjourned.